Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of The Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
I'll just push it out of the way.
Don't touch that wire. Any fallen power line could be live and dangerous. If you see a fallen power line, call the police or the power company right away.
And don't touch it. You could get the shock of your life.
Stay with me. I'm on you like glue.
All right.
Hi, guys. Can I skate with you?
Nah, you're just a girl.
Power glide.
Aren't you jumping to conclusions? Let her try. You might be surprised.
Okay, but
thanks!
Wow, look at that! All right!
Remember, don't judge people till you give them a chance.
Now we know.
And knowing is half the battle.
The Transformers!
Come on, throw it! Ow! Hey, I was safe! Ow! Let's get him!
Hold on there!
Cutter! They started it! We did not!
Well, fighting won't stop it. When people disagree, sometimes they need someone who's not involved to settle things.
Johnny Kadump, he's not rooting for either team.
Good thinking. Instead of fighting when you disagree, look for a better way.
Now we know.
And knowing is half the battle.
G.I. Joe!
Why, hello. It is 27 minutes after the hour of 1, and this is the month of January in the year of our Lord, 2010. Thank you for coming by and making a part of your listening day. We are live, I say, from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious, but they are hate-filled studios of the Emerson News Network. Thank you for coming by and joining us on this very fine Tuesday. It is Tuesday, and welcome to Day 12. It's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505. I got that tart mouth going on from the... for the Vizo here. It's a 503-505-6964, 503-505-6964. If you would like to be part of today's radio program, our excursion into whimsy and merriment, it's 503-505-6964. If you would like to get in touch with your comments, questions, clarifications, observations, ruminations, ponderings, musings of what nature, Don? Fail! An ironic nature.
Oh, ironic. Yes. An ironic nature.
It is ironic. No, it's not. Is it ironic that you couldn't think of that? It's not. It's a word like ironic, but not ironic.
It actually is ironic that I could not think of the word ironic.
Is
in
it,
that
though?
It is. In this particular case, yes.
See, now I don't even know. I've spent so many years of my life correcting people for misusing the word irony that now I have become all I once despised. Now I never even know if it's correct.
No, that was genuinely ironic.
But I don't think it was. We can't stop. No. We have to stop right now. That's me not talking to you. That's me talking to myself. I'm interrupting myself. Isn't that right? Yes. We can't go down this path. I will make this one observation. They don't sell this anymore. It was like they discontinued it the second I went to buy it. Fark.com, which is a site that I don't read much anymore, only because it's a great website. The reason I don't go to Fark anymore is because at one point Clear Channel put out this memo to all of their DJs telling them that it was part of their required show prep as Clear Channel radio hosts to go to Fark every day and just to, you know, troll for interesting and quirky news stories about which you can make pithy comments stolen from message boards and they can masquerade as your own wit. And so I just quit going to Fark because I didn't want to be duplicating all the stuff the Clear Channel guys were doing. But they used to sell the best shirt. And on the front, it was just like on the little, like on the left boob or whatever, it just said like Fark. But on the back, in huge, it was a black shirt and in huge block capital letters on the back. Like you were a member of the SWAT team or you were like a federal marshal or something. It just said Irony Police. And it's like, I so badly wanted that shirt because that was, you know, It was one of those things. But for a while, it just seemed like everybody. It seems like people were almost willfully misusing the word around me just to provoke a reaction. But it's like I have burned out the circuit board section of my head that was actually responsible for discerning correct uses of irony versus incorrect uses. And now I can't even tell the difference. It's like I'm so deep in the forest, I can't even find my way out. But you believe it was a correct use?
I do believe that.
All
yes.
All right. Well, we're just going to go with that. I just don't. It causes me too much agita even to think about it. It is 503-505-6964. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. That is rick@rickemerson.com. Don Taylor can be emailed. That is Don, D-A-W-N, @rickemerson.com. You can also get in touch via the message board. You can just write something on a piece of papyrus and put it inside a bottle and kick it into the ocean like the guy in B.C. if you would like to. The chat box is online on the website, and I think it said the thing about Skyping already. Whatever. If you want to find
us, instant messages on AOL.
Get on Aimster, won't you please? Here's the thing. If you've really got something important to say, you'll find a way. You'll figure it out. So I'm tired of chewing your food for you. And in any event, this is all true. Coming up later on the day, we got your clown watch, also geek watch, religious nutcase watch on the way today, and the top five. So these are the top five song segments or portions with which everybody in the room must sing along. Maybe not the entire song, maybe not the chorus, maybe not the hook. It's part of a song, a segment, a moment, a fragment, a little snatch of the recording. It happens every, whether it's once or several times repeated throughout the composition and the performance. Everybody in the room must sing along with that moment. Let me ask you this. Is the example we used yesterday on the list?
No, it is not. I decided since we had used that song, well, I'd say because we started talking about this because of Sweet Caroline.
Now, I want to know if I could use that as an example, but I want to
give
it away.
Yeah, go ahead and use that because I decided we already did that song yesterday.
So it's how everybody in Sweet Caroline, dun, 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 like everybody in the room must do the dun, dun, dun part. So it is a top five consisting of other moments like that in other songs. Awesome. Did you use a... I don't even know if I want to know or not. Did you use any of the examples I sent you last night?
Yes, I did. All three of
Fantastic.
Them. Fantastic. I figured I'd use your three and my three, blend them together.
It's gold is what that is, Don. In any event, it's 503-505-6964 if you would like to participate in today's program to whatever degree and in whatever fashion. Here's another thing about that opening that we just played. So the first... There's three back-to-back there, those PSAs, all of them produced by the same animation company because I think they were all Hasbro products, G.I. Joe Transformers, and then the first one was Gem. Somebody asked what that was. It was Gem. So it was Gem telling you to stay away from the power lines. That was the Transformers telling you to tolerate those who are different because they, too, have their story and their part to play in the human play, you know, thing.
Yes, Rick. Don't judge others until you give them a chance.
That's right. To prove that they are the idiots you rashly assumed them to be. So everyone is a threat in the human tapestry. Then the final one of the three there is that is G.I. Joe. But here's the thing that I don't quite get about that. And maybe this is because I did not own. I mean, I owned my fair amount of G.I. Joe. Toys and the sort of like I had the command fortress and whatever. But I don't remember there being a G.I. Joe character named Cutter. I don't really know that you could have a children's toy named Cutter now. It seems like unless it was something that you just sold at Hot Topic or something like
that
to the My Chemical Romance shirts.
The sad, lonely, emo G.I. Joe guy.
Seriously, just covered in scars and weeping.
He came with his own little bathtub that he just sat on the edge of while he sliced into his thigh.
Did he come with his little like unopenable composition journal? Into which he could just write sections of the bell jar. What was it? I don't even remember who Cutter was. I mean, what was it? Where did the name even come from? I mean, do you have any recollection of there being a G.I. Joe character named Cutter?
I didn't really pay a whole lot of attention to G.I. Joe, honestly.
Well, fine. Well, la-di-da. I'll have to play it back and see if I've misheard it at some point. I'll have to reopen that here. In any event. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Don Taylor is tracking the following headlines for you on this Tuesday. Yes?
I just have this image now in my head of, like, a G.I. Joe guy all, like, decked out like some, like, Cure-loving... early 80s goth kid. Sort of like when Garth... Was it Garth Brooks?
Chris Gaines, when he was doing the Chris Gaines thing.
Kind of like that, only it's like a G.I. Joe guy with the black wig and
just sort of sad.
Yes.
With like a, you know, the kung fu grip. It's just sort of like a power slouch, you know?
he's wearing just sort of a black trench coat. and he has shaggy black hair, but he still has, like, you know, huge muscles, and he's all articulated.
The better with which to grip a razor blade. Those long, long nights during which thoughts of suicide are your only solace.
Yes, G.I. Joe with broken piece of mirror grip. Anyway, the news we have, the FDA has ordered some lower doses of painkiller in prescription painkillers. Oprah was pregnant when she was 14 and talks to Piers Morgan about it. And Sarah Palin defends the whole crosshairs map thing.
Did you watch the? Did you watch any of the Oprah thing on the Piers Morgan show?
A little bit of it, yeah.
What did you think?
I liked the part where she talked about drinking detergent. That just really pleased me.
Well, how else are you going to wash down 30 pounds of macaroni and cheese,
yeah.
Don? Really? Come on.
Oh, God. Because she's just like us.
Yes, that's right. She's just plain folks. She's just regular people. So we'll get to all of that. So that is coming up later in the day. Clown Watch, Geek Watch, Religious Nutcase Watch, Top 5, those headlines.
And by the way, there's also a Snuff Watch.
Really?
Yes.
Did it just happen?
It happened yesterday, and I think I failed to get to it yesterday. I'm not sure if I failed to get to it yesterday or if it just happened, but it is, yes, it is a recent development.
Is it somebody of note?
It is indeed.
Is it somebody that I should know?
Oh, yes. You will know who this person is.
Well, now I'm perplexed because
I'm surprised you did not hear about this.
Because I'm pretty sure that I was on the internet last night, sort of, you know, just... Do people surf the internet anymore?
I don't think so. I always say I'm poking around on the internet. That's how I put it.
But you're rummaging. I'm foraging on the internet. I'm busy burying nuts of all varieties on various websites this evening. I can't go out with you. I'm sorry.
I'm scampering about on the internet. That's
surfing
what
is one of those... I wonder when we quit saying surfing the internet.
I don't know.
It was always... Here's the thing. Don't you think that the verb surfing to denote that you were online going from one place to another... That had a very short shelf life. There was, like, about, I don't know, maybe, like, 2 or 3 years where that seemed like a sort of hip, cutting-edge thing to do, and then immediately just became sort of childish and embarrassing.
I always wonder who the first person was who said something and how we all started saying it. Because, like, the thing... Because usually these things just irritate me, and that's why I wonder who started this and why now I have to say this. The one that lately has been annoying me the much is the cloud. That started, like, you know...
I say that.
It started just this last year that we decided, sort of en masse, we decided that everything that isn't just downloaded into our computer and is stored elsewhere out there on the internet, that's out, that's the cloud. It's out in the cloud. And that had to come from somewhere.
I think, honestly, now I think I may actually know the answer to this. Now, he didn't create it. He didn't create the term, but I do believe, I could be wrong about this, and I probably am. Here's the thing, I'm almost certainly wrong about this. I'm definitely wrong.
Okay.
I'm making this up.
All right.
Somebody will correct me about this, but the first person I heard use that in any way that was sort of a popularization of the term was Mark Andreessen, who used to be at Netscape, but who then formed. It might actually be called like Cloudscape or something, but he formed a startup a few years back, and their whole thing was the so-called cloud computing, and they were going to try to popularize that. And that is actually, I think, the first time I heard that phrase used the way that we use it now, which is sort of externalized storage of applications, memory, data, whatever. Because I remember there was some article about him in, I don't know, like Slashdot or something. There was something, you know, like Netscape, you know, founder Mark Andreessen forming a new company to popularize cloud computing. And I thought, well, that's fantastic. What is it? And I had no, and it was like, I just pictured sort of Lando Calrissian speeding along and poking numbers and, you know, into a dashboard, you know, calculator of some kind. And then I looked it up and it was, you know, I saw the whatever. But that was the first time I heard it used.
We seem to be in this this era of technology right now that's sort of like, the 1950s and early 60s with advertising, when people would just start mimicking things that they heard in ads without actually knowing what they meant.
Right.
You know, it's like, well, yes, it's moisturizing. Yes, it's filled with more, it has 19 vitamins and minerals that will help build my body.
It's fortified.
It's fortified. Yeah, it's, you know, and they still do that with ladies' products all the time. Skin creams and hair stuff and makeup. They'll tell you, you know, it has... you know, it has moisture globules or something like that. You know, it has serum. That's the, it has little serum capsules. And you're going, well, good. It must be good for me. It has serum. And we don't know what that means. And that has actually happened now because everybody now has laptops and home computers and phones. And it's now happened with technology now where people are just walking around blithely going, oh, well, 4G. 4G is better than 3G. I better go with this company because they've got 4G. And you, well, what does that mean? What is a G?
4G is my hip hop.
No one knows. No one knows. And it's the same thing with the cloud. You actually see commercials now where they're saying, and it, oh, let's go to the cloud. Some guy says to his wife in their kitchen when they're going to net surf something, you know, and it's like going, you people have no idea what you're talking about. You're just making us say things.
Did you just say when they're going to net surf something? Were you being something. Ironic there? I don't think so. It seemed like that was just the phrase your brain came up with.
It was. They're going to net
Honey,
surf something.
Let us go net surf some movie listings.
But I
fantastic.
Did. I saw one of these things where the guy says, to the cloud. And they go
and
off to jump on their laptop to look something up. And I'm just, you're just making us say things.
That's awesome. Well, that's like our discussion the other day about how everything suddenly became infused. You know, it wasn't like they just stuck some crap in a can and sold it to you. No. You know, it's infused with jalapeno taste.
Also, everything has to have sea salt now. Just regular salt isn't good enough. It's sea salt, which just makes me think, though, doesn't a large amount of salt just come from the ocean anyway?
Yes.
Isn't that how we manufacture salt?
I believe so.
So McDonald's or Burger King, whoever it is, telling me that there's sea salt on their French fries, I'll bet you anything it's the exact same salt they've always used.
Hold on a second. Let me augment my own embarrassment. Never let it be said that Rick Emerson is unwilling to make himself the goat, as Charlie Brown used to say. I do have with me now one of my many hair products. KMS California Hair Play, and it is in fact sea salt spray, which I was sort of horked into buying by the well-endowed young woman behind the counter at Bishop's some time ago. Apparently, Dawn, it adds fullness and texture like a day at the beach. I didn't even see that. That's retarded.
Do you know what your hair is like after a day at the beach? It's awful.
It's filled with dirt and crabs.
And it's dry and nasty looking because it's all covered with sea salt.
Really, it's just like straw, and it smells like moss and death. All right.
The first thing you do when you get home from a day at the beach is take a shower to get the beach out of your hair.
By the way, avoid spraying directly in eyes, Don. Okay.
Let me see this.
Oh, hey, no. It's also got grape and peppermint. What am I buying? What kind of idiot am I? I don't even want to tell you how much this cost. I'm going to take the price tag off. Seriously, I'm going to hand this to you, but I'm taking the price tag off. I'll make you guess. I don't even want to tell you. All right.
Oh, God.
No, let's not dwell on that.
Hair play.
Just shut up. You just shut up over there.
Oh, my God.
By the way, somebody has sent us a text. They want us to know that the cloud means the internet.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, sir, madam. I appreciate that.
Ooh, it has IOPS technology.
You know, my fist is going to have some IOP technology right in your face. That's what it's going to have. All right. I'll just let you read that for as long as it takes to find more objects of ridicule. That's okay. Would you like to know this? Here's another thing.
Oh, it makes you tousled, it says. It recreates the look and feel you get from a day at the beach. Tousled, sexy, with fullness and a light matte finish.
I'm going to tousle you upside your head.
Do you feel tousled and sexy after you use this?
Well, I mean, I feel more tousled and more sexy, if that's what you mean, Don. Let's see. That is actually one of two... Here's, by the way, in case you were asking yourself, at what point did Rick Emerson become a woman? The answer was when I started...
It smells like Kool-Aid.
Here's the thing about now, I have to say, in my own defense, I like KMS hair products quite a lot. But I also have to admit, because I can't lie about this, I am in fact carrying on my person, I mean, they're not like in my pants or anything, but it's like in this, it's in my European carry-all.
It's in your girly hair products bag.
My satchel. I am carrying two different KMS. This is not like two different bottles of the same thing. Two different KMS hair play products. The other one is molding. But I wonder what this one is. That one's sea salt. I wonder if this was like, you know, Himalayan yak hair or something. That, you know, the other thing is like, have you noticed that it's not just sea salt? And you're right that all salt, I think, comes from the sea.
Well, what not all of it, but a lot of it does.
But what is the deal with they're getting salt from, like, I don't know, like on top of a mountain or something so you can put it in your cookies? What is that? Where you're like, what are you going to make? I'm going to make some cupcakes. Well, you better get some salt from the middle of the Mojave. And it's like, you know, and it's special because it's like blue. And it costs like $40 a pound or something. Read my wife.
Yeah, I'm baffled by the whole different tasting expensive salt phenomenon.
Hey, by the way, by God, this has IOPS technology too. No wonder my hair looks so full of life.
Well, they are part of the same hair care system. The KMS California Hair Play system. Does that make you tousled and sexy too?
It does. Also, apparently, it makes me piercing. No, it makes me piecing. What does that mean?
Piecing is so that
this does things I can't even explain.
Yeah.
What is piecing for my hair?
That's when it kind of sticks apart in spiky little bits.
It doesn't.
That's piecing.
Okay. Well, I think this is more hair product than I probably need. I think this is for someone more attractive than myself.
Well, no, that you're attractive now because
now with the sea
because
salt.
You're tousled and you look like you just came from a day at the beach.
By the way, you can suck a full bag is what you can do. And B, would you like to take a wager as to how much that sea salt hairspray cost me?
$23.
No, see, in your face, it was only $17.
Oh, okay.
God damn, I'm stupid. Wow.
See, I get the stuff done at the salon, and I look to see what it is they're using. And then I go to Walgreens, and I find something that's similar but costs, like, $3.
See, the thing is, that's because you're not entranced by the power of bosoms. When they are attached to the woman behind the counter who just finished cutting your hair, and so therefore I feel like we have a bond. And then she says, would you like any product today? And I forget with whom I was having this discussion the other day. God, where the hell was I? Oh, it was at Aaron Duran's with the release party for Aaron Duran's comic. I should say, by the way, that these ruminations on my various hair products brought to you by EH Vending. Contact them at ehvending.com. That is ehvending.com. I was there with Dan Clark was there. Pirate Dan Clark. By the way, when is the last time you saw Dan Clark of Portland Yar or whatever, the Portland Pirate Group or whatever?
About a month or so ago. I had him on Ham-Fisted Radio about a month or so back.
That beard of his is really, it's like, I mean, I'm not saying it's bad. It's good. It's just, it's nearly out of control. It's going to take over the world. It's like the beard that ate Miami.
Yeah, he's been on Ham-Fisted Radio twice, and we ended up devoting a sizable amount of time to just talking about his beard.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. And I asked him sort of jokingly, because Scott Daly was there, and Scott Daly had, I'm not saying it's a bad haircut, but it is one of those haircuts where it's like, and I really am not saying it's a bad haircut, but you do wonder what the point of it is. Because Scott Daly's hair, and I have a feeling that there's a woman behind this. This is probably something his girlfriend decided he should do. And so, you know, being a guy, he just went along. Where his hair is cut so short that it's like you almost wonder why stop. Like, and I'm not saying, like, it's not like he's losing his hair. I mean, it's just that it's cut unbelievably short. It's that thing, but it's the weird thing where it is cut so close to his scalp, and yet it's not sticking up like a crew cut. It is somehow still laying flat, but it's like unbelievably short. It's like, what is it, that thing that George Clooney ever wore, like the Caesar or something?
Oh, yeah. God, I hated that.
Okay, it's not quite that. It's even shorter and closer, and yet somehow still lays down, which I guess must have something to do with the texture of his hair or whatever. But it's like, it makes you wonder, like, why even leave the hair? Like, why not just go all the way down to the scalp? It's mystifying.
Well, there's the, my husband used to get his hair cut that short simply because he only wanted to get his hair cut, like, twice a year. So he'd get it cut, like, all the way off.
Right.
Like, and then he knew that, you know, he could go like
in
6 months.
In June, get it cut again.
And then in 6 months, when he had the big bushy, like, you know, guy from Eight Is Enough kind of mid-80s do.
The Willie Ames.
He'd have the big bushy Willie Ames haircut, which, by the way, he had when I met him.
Awesome.
Then he'd just go get it all cut back off again. It's like, okay, I'm good for six more months.
When Patrick's hair grows out, does he get the white man's fro? Does he get like a Garfunkel?
He used to. It used to get really thick. Now it's just.
I demand photos.
Now his hair has gone largely gray, so now it just starts to look kind of crazy.
But I mean, does it curl though? Does he get like a Christopher Lloyd kind of a thing?
No, it just gets bushy. It just gets long and bushy.
All right, so I guess maybe I have to.
It really was the sort of Willie Ames kind of just. You know, it wasn't really curly per se,
but
it was
just
sort
of
thick and.
It's like someone's put an air hose in it, and it's just expanding.
Yeah, that was. I have pictures of him from his 20s.
I demand to see them, and in exchange, I'll show you a picture of me with a bad mullet, because you know those are not really hard to find.
Speaking of bishops, though, by the way, because Patrick hasn't gone yet, but we got this card because they just opened a shop in Bridgeport Village.
Right.
So since we're in the vicinity, we got this mailer where it's like, bring in this card and get a free haircut. And so we have this sitting aside so he can go get a free haircut. And we were looking to see what their hours were. And I jumped online and looked at their website and realized, like you were saying about the big-bosomed woman pushing you to buy the things. Whereas we had talked before about Dutch Brothers Coffee and Hooters.
Yeah.
Am I mistaken, or from looking at their website anyway, does Bishop's kind of employ a similar thing where they have attractive young women who cut your hair and call you sweetie and make you want to keep coming back because you think they're flirting with you?
Well, that's
what it looks like from their website.
Well, how do I put this? That they don't do it. I'm just saying this because it's true. I know that Bishop's, for whatever reason, is a very divisive place. I know a lot of people who really reflexively disdain Bishop's. I will say that I go there. All kidding aside, I go there because I get a really great haircut there. Now, part of the reason for that is because I go on a pretty regular basis, and there's like two or three people that I kind of rotate through. I pretty much have, you know, there's a handful of people that cut my hair just because I go to the same place and I go to the same location and I go again on a regular schedule. So the people who cut my hair now have been doing it for some time. They do not do an overtly, they don't do like a corny, tacky, overtly sexy thing the way that like Hooters does. Now, you know who does do that? There is a place downtown called Hair M. A little play on words that.
See, because here's their website, and I swear to God, the first thing you see.
Oh, well, that's they just show the chick with the big cans.
Yeah.
But that's not like that's not who's cutting your hair. You know, okay. That is. Well, have you ever seen the photo that Sarah did for Bishop's?
No.
Sarah was a model for Bishop's, and she is. Everyone, just calm yourself. She's topless. But it's like she's topless. She's holding her dog, her Muppet. That's not code. But it was like she had just gotten her hair cut there. And that's one of their things, is that they have really sort of attractive, in a very specific way, people who model. And it's like a lot of alt. It's like a lot of young punk-looking kids.
Okay.
And men as well as women. And if you go into Bishop's, you know what it's like? Going into Bishop's, your hair is going to be cut by somebody who looks like it was either work there or work at Mike Clark's Movie Madness. That's what it is. So it's kind of they have the punk thing going on. But there is a place, I know what you're talking about. There is a place called Hair M downtown. And their whole deal is, and I went there because they were an advertiser on Max 910. And so I went there. And to be fair, I mean, I guess I got to get a haircut, I suppose. But their deal is you go in and I think their slogan is actually like, you know, it's like where, you know, a man is treated like a king or something. And it's just embarrassing because you go in and they give you the blade shave, which is kind of cool. I mean, I'm for that because it's a good way to get a shave and then you're good for a couple days. But they give you the hot towel thing and the whole whatever, the old school shave. All of that is fine. And it's like they give you a pretty decent haircut. But the whole thing is that it's like chicks with big cans in tight shirts. And they do the thing of calling you like honey and sweetie and baby, and like everywhere you look in the place is a flat screen TV that either has ESPN on it or like an Xbox hooked up, and it's the sort of thing that like it should be sort of great, right? Like you should be like, this is awesome, there's a flat screen and there's Xbox and a chick with big boobs and I'm getting a haircut, whoa. But it's like you just feel, I guess to me it's like the same reason I can't get turned on at like a strip club, because it's like at least, because it's not even like a good faking of interest in me. Like, the pretending isn't even well done.
Yeah.
Like, the transaction is too much on the surface there. And so I just, you know, and it's just, guys don't like to be reminded that they're basically just, you know, meat, formed into the shape of an ATM. But what was my point? So at Bishop's, it's not really that. It's just that Bishop's, they do the thing of everybody there seems, again, like at Mike Clark's Movie Madness on Belmont, which is a store I quite like. You know that thing when you're a Movie Madness and everybody behind the counter seems one or two shades cooler than you will ever be?
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, you know about all kinds of weird French films that I've never seen in my life. That's the thing at Bishop's. You're like, you really know, a lot about how to dress and how to put yourself together in a way that I will never understand. And so now I will do whatever you want. And also, let's be honest, a lot of them are like 20-something punk chicks. And so that's kind of hot. But they're not like cloying about it. They don't do the whole like, they don't ladle it on, or I don't think it could go anymore, because that's a thing that really just, that does really grate on me. That's nearly as bad as when the barber just wants to talk to you endlessly and goes, so how's your day? But anyway, so like at Aaron's, it's so funny we bring this up because this all ties into my interview this morning for Outlook Portland that I did with Seth Aaron from Project Runway, who, by the way, was like, I got to just tell you, he was like the coolest guy in the history of, he was, we're going to have him, I believe, on this show at some point.
Good.
So he was really, really quite, he was quite fantastic. But
I was quite a fan. I do enjoy Project Runway, and And I enjoyed him on the show, actually. I was glad to see him win.
Yeah, he was really a cool guy. But so I was at Aaron's release party, and so I'm talking to Scott Daly and the Pirate Dan and whatever, and the Dan's got this huge beard on, and I guess he's going to be competing in, like, Team Beard USA, you know, their, like, finals or something for, like, greatest beard in the Western Hemisphere. He's going to be in something. But I asked him jokingly, I said, hey, so is there, like, do they make a special beard-only conditioner or something? Ha, ha, ha. Thinking it's not true. Apparently it is true, and he owns it. And he actually said, and it was like some sort of peach extract product or something that he like lovingly massages into his beard. And so then there was like three of us standing in a sort of like crude circle talking about our hair care products. Three guys in a comic book store talking about the salon products. And I told this story about how Laura was going through and she was trying to clean up the bathroom and just sort of tidy up our stuff because my mom was coming to visit us a few weeks ago. And in the bathroom, we have this thing. It's like a basket by the sink. And it's the basket where you keep the stuff you use every day, like your hairbrush and not like your toothbrush, but like your hairbrush and your hair products and maybe like, I don't know, like, I don't know, just, you know, like maybe you're like deodorant or something. Like it all kind of sits in this basket by the sink. And she was trying to like go through and get rid of stuff because she was like, oh, we got all of this stuff in here. And then I came in and like it was all gone. And I was like, Baby, where's my peppermint sea salt, you know, hairspray or whatever? Like, I was asking where my stuff was. And she's like, I put that in a bag to throw away. And I said, what do you mean to throw away? And she's like, well, you don't use any of that stuff. Like, do you? Don't you just use, like, regular hair? And I was like, no, I use all of that. And she didn't. She somehow disbelieved it, and so she brought the bag in from the kitchen, and she said, look, we're not going to keep anything that you don't use at least once a week, because that's a waste of space and a waste of money. And so we went through it, one at a time, and improbably, there were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 separate and distinct hair care products, all of which I used at least once a week. And it was just the most, and it's like, you know, but and I could say it was embarrassing, and I guess it sort of is, but I mean, it's like it also just, like, I don't know how I got to this stage of my life. I really don't know when that, if you look at me in high school where I've got a bad mullet and I'm just spraying Aquanet into my face every day, I don't know how I transitioned from being that guy to being a guy who has 5 separate hair care products, 3 of which are conditioners. The hell is that about? I just don't even know. It's like you just look into the mirror and you go, who am I?
You never know when someone might touch your tousled, sexy, pieced, just home from the beach hair, and you want it to be soft thanks to the mango extracts and panda saliva or whatever it is that you're buying.
You know, it's like one of those things, like it's like in The Big Chill or something, you know, when they're talking about, you know, they're talking about, you know, like their stock purchasing and, you know, and how they're going to be doing some insider trading for the sale of Kevin Klein's footwear company. And, you know, they have this long moment where, you know, William Hurt realizes that they have, you know, they have become the enemy that they once fought against or whatever. And my equivalent of that is just like looking at this like huge rack of toiletries I've got at home and just wondering when it is that I decided that I needed, yes, a mango peach mint leave-in conditioner, which I was sold like 3 years ago and which I now have to replace 4 or 5 times a year for like $45. Somebody says, when I think tousled and sexy, I think Rick Emerson. Almost never. Thanks so much. I appreciate that. Well, in any event, I'll just stick these back in the bag. I don't even want to tell you how much this molding paste cost, Don. The key, by the way, to this is to emulsify this in your hands before you use it, or so I'm told.
I have used all of those things over the years, depending on my particular style of the moment.
You got way more hair than I do, though.
I mean, I have a lot of hair.
You know, and the irony is that when I had really long hair,
I have a lot
of
hair, and I use almost nothing in it, particularly compared to you.
It's like when I had really long, when I had hair to my waist, basically, I didn't do anything. I mean, I would just get out of the shower, and I would kind of go with a towel, and then I would like drag a comb through it, and I think just sort of like splitting it into a billion little, like, you know, split ends. But I would never really do anything to it. And so I think it is that thing when I started, when I cut my hair, and then later on when I became, you know, when I became aware that, like, you know, this hair might not necessarily be there forever if I don't take care of that somehow. I think that's when I became hyper aware of it.
Well, and then when you paid extra for hair.
That's right.
And you suffered painful surgery.
That's
to
right.
Have hair.
Well, you know, what's
so
the point?
I can't fault you for spending a lot of time on your hair because, you know, you've actually suffered to have that hair.
Here's the thing. If you're going to buy an expensive car, you know, that's a thing. You're going to take it and then get the oil change every now and again. What's the point of buying that Porsche if you're not going to polish it? As Aaron Duran once said, I went from having a receding hairline to receding my hairline. And so forth. All right. You can just hand me that sea salt spray back there. I will say real quickly, anybody who is a fan of Project Runway, and I'm not going to pretend that I haven't watched it. I don't watch it all the time. I'm not religious about it like my wife is. But here's the thing about Project Runway. It's a show that I sort of... She didn't convince me to watch it. I mean, she doesn't try to force me to watch stuff if she doesn't think I'll like it. But I think she was hoping that I would like it, even though I don't typically like most reality programming. But I got to tell you, although I don't watch it all the time, that is a show that I will find myself like. I don't ever get sucked into like, you know, the goddamn Housewives of some, you know, horrible suburb somewhere, you know, or like even old school stuff like The Real World. I quit watching like a long time ago, you know, or like any of the like Celebrity Rehab or like Rock of Love. Like, I don't watch any of the stuff.
Yeah, I don't. I watch almost no reality TV. I like the things like Project Runway and Top Chef, where it's people who are actually good at what they do.
Good at something, right. That's the thing. Is they actually are, they have a skill at something. Which is why, like, of the dancing shows, like, I don't really, like, I don't watch any of those, but I think if I did, I would always choose the one that actually has the, what is it, the,
So You Think You Can Dance?
Because it's people can actually do it. It's not like you just got, like, it's not like they got Florence Henderson or something out there. You know, hey, Vicky Lawrence, do a tango, or whatever. So we had on Outlook Portland this morning, and it's going to air this coming Sunday, and it'll also be on our YouTube channel. So we interviewed Seth Aaron. So he was the winner of Season 8, lives in Vancouver, originally from Season 7, rather, originally from San Diego, now lives in Vancouver. And I had seen him, because Laura had pointed him out to me. She's like, hey, there's this guy from, you know, the guy from Portland. He's from Vancouver. She's like, there's a guy from here, and he's competing. And, you know, he was the guy that she was rooting for the entire time. And I've heard from a lot of people who said that they rooted for him, and not just because he was from Vancouver, just because they really liked him. They thought that he was a good guy and had a lot of talent and seemed... And he does have a sort of a... He does have a sort of, like, regular guy sort of vibe to him, although he's like a regular guy who's like way more stylish than I will ever be. So Cheryl, you know, working the magic that she works, conjured up an appearance from Seth Aaron on Outlook Portland. So we interviewed him this morning, and it's like, and it's the thing. This is how my brain works. Not unlike how I have the five different hair care products. By the way, none of which are really, I mean, it's not like any of them are really making me into a much more attractive person. You know what I mean? It's like, they call it like a game of inches in football. I mean, the distance between me and like hot guy is so vast and so great. There is no hair care product that is going to turn me into a sexy, sexy man. I mean, at most, the trying to make me really good looking by changing my hair care products is like having a piece of meat in your hand and deciding that you are going to cook it by getting on top of a mountain so you're somewhat closer to the sun. It doesn't really work. It just gets you incrementally closer in a totally non-effective way. Reed also, last night, you know, you've seen the sort of, you know, like I have the kind of stock, I have the couple of suits that I rotate through for Outlook Portland, and one of those items is a cream-colored shirt that I wear because that way it doesn't glare on camera. And I have a couple of those, but the thing about the cream-colored, or, you know, about the shirt is that over time you get that makeup line around the collar, and it just, you know, starts to show up on camera, and that makeup doesn't come out after a while. And so, what do I do, but it's been that way for, like, weeks. I mean, for, like, 3 or 4 months, I think, those shirts have been approaching the point where it's like I had to replace them because the makeup no longer wanted to come out of the, I had a terrible case of ring around the collar, as they used to say. But, you know, I was able to choke it down for all of the other interviews. Last night, though, realizing that I was about to be interviewing the guy from Project Runway, what do I immediately do? Oh, my God, I've got to get another shirt. As though that's going to make any difference when I'm sitting next to the guy from Project Runway, who I think just falls out of bed and lands in a pile of fantastic on his way to the studio. You know?
Yeah, but you don't want to feel like he's looking over at you and just looking at the collar of your shirt and going, really?
I guess.
Yeah.
But I was sitting there this morning just thinking, like, why am I even, you know, why am I even trying? Why am I even attempting? Because that is not like a front or a put on, like the fact that that guy just knows what he's doing. I mean, that's when I realized that when I was talking to Seth Aaron, that you, it's kind of like with Sarah, you know, with Sarah Dillon, where it's like some people you could just put them in front of a shelf that has 15 different pieces of clothing and accessories, and you say, 13 of these 15 things work really well together. Tell me which ones. And I would never be able to figure that out. And there are certain people who just, well, you, I mean, you're very well put together, as they say. And I just, you have the ability to suss out what works, even when it doesn't logically seem like two things ought to go together, you know when they will. And you also know that with cooking, I think. You know, two flavors that might seem, it might seem counterintuitive to put them together, but you know that when you blend them, it will form something great.
But I'm also, I will say that I have reached a point in my life where, thank God, I finally just like stopped caring all of the time. Because like a lot of women, I was so self-conscious about myself all of the time, all the way through my 20s and probably into my early 30s, where it was like, you know, if I was going out of the house, if I was going to do anything, I had to make sure I had mascara on and I'd look at the hair and I brushed my hair compulsively. And thank God, I just really don't care that much anymore. But the fact that I don't care that much means, you know, yes, I know how to make myself presentable, but also there are times that I'm aware that I am just like failing miserably and I just have to not care. Like this morning was one of those mornings. Patrick had to be at work at 7:45. And so I rolled out of bed at 7:20, and because we had to leave the house at 7:30. And I threw some clothes on.
Wrapping yourself in a poncho.
And I looked in the mirror and my hair, I had like the Gumby head where my hair was just standing straight up on one side. So I like just ran a hairbrush underwater and brushed it through my hair because I figured this way I'll look like I just showered if anyone looks at me. And I realized I had no coffee. I had run out of coffee, but I had this $5 Starbucks gift card. So I had to go to Starbucks to get coffee. So in like, you know, my hoodie and my, you know, my jeans, all stuff, no makeup on, my hair just barely combed into place. So like bleary eyed, drop hat off work, go to the Starbucks, go up and go like try and figure what's the most value I could get for my $5 Starbucks. Give me a 20-ounce Americano with a little bit of room for cream. Just give me as much coffee as I can get for like $2.95. So I'm waiting for this and I'm just sitting there and this woman comes in who is about my age, but she's also one of those women that's obviously trying to cheat, you know, age.
Right.
So she's obviously put together for work, and she has very tight jeans on and this sort of long sweater concoction. And she's standing there with her shoulders thrown back and her tits out and her stomach, like, pulled in. And she has, like, this long mane of bleach blonde hair and just a mask of perfect makeup. And I'm sitting in a chair near the coffee thing, near the barista, because I can't even be bothered to stand while I wait for my coffee to show up.
Cow pattern pajamas.
Yeah, practically, yeah. And I very obviously am just barely dressed and conscious. And she looks over at me, and the look she gave me of just such disdain. And I'm just looking at her, and I'm just thinking, God, I'm glad I just don't care anymore.
That you've reached the point where you can just, you know.
Where I can just go, yes, of course you disdain me, but you know what? I don't care.
I think for me, see, it's weird because we're kind of like tag team wrestlers here because I went through most of my life, I think, not caring because I just sort of figured like, you know, well, this is what I got, you know. But then, like, in some ways, like the very worst thing that ever happened was doing any amount of television work. Because then it's like you just become hyper aware of it. And also, and you and I have talked about this, where when somebody does your makeup, like you sort of sit there for a few minutes and they go over your face and they sort of blend everything in and they try to, you know, they even if they, and then it's like you look in the mirror and you go, my God, for the first time ever, I look human. But then it's just sort of sad, you know? I think that must be what it's like if you take ecstasy or something, you know? And you see the world as it could be through a brightly colored technicolor, you know, the prism of kaleidoscopic beauty. But then later you wake up and you're hungover and it's like you just see this sort of dingy, unalloyed, you know, ugliness of the world. Once somebody, like, sort of takes the time to make you look presentable, then it's like you become ever more self-conscious about it. And once you see yourself on camera, too, that's when you just think to yourself, like, my God, I can never leave the house again without serious, like, undergarment support to hold in my expanding flab and also, like, a layer of foundation, at least.
Well, that's one of the reasons that I'm, one of the reasons among many that I'm, like, trying to eat better and I'm trying to lose weight. It's because we're doing this now and I've had to have pictures taken. And we go places and people want to take their picture with me. And then they post that picture to the internet. And I'm fine with the fact that I'm, like, spherical. I've actually gotten okay about the fact that I'm, like, a short, round person. It's not that. It's my face. My face has gotten puffy and muttony. You know?
Muttony. I don't even know what that means.
And I was not especially photogenic to begin with. And I think in person, I'm actually a relatively good-looking person.
You feel you don't photograph well.
But I really don't photograph well. And being fat and having a pudgy, muttony, mushy, doughy face isn't helping
that's any. Nitpicking.
So it's like purely vanity. I realize that there's like, oh, it's for my health. And after my husband was in the hospital, I realized I have to take care of it. No, it's so I'll look prettier in pictures. That's it.
By the way, in case you're feeling bad about your vanity, I should tell you this, that I wasn't gonna say this part, but not only did I buy, I mean, it sounds like I'm trying to get him to take me to the spring formal. Not only did I buy a new shirt last night, you know, for sitting next to Seth Aaron this morning. Not only that, not only do I apparently tote around, you know, like a flatbed's worth of hair care products with me. But I did, in fact, make sure that I stopped by Sephora to pick up a new container of Summer Bisque, blending foundation.
That's nice. The thing about Seth
and a Wolverine hairbrush.
The thing about Seth Aaron that always struck me is that you remember back when we thought Trent Reznor, like, seemed kind of cool?
Yeah.
But then we found out that he'd been like a band, you know, like the band majorette,
like a flautist or something,
in high school, and that he was really just a huge dork, and not that interesting. Seth Aaron to me seems like what we used to think that Trent Reznor was actually like.
Yeah, he is that guy, I think.
Yeah, where he's got like the cool tattoos, but he doesn't seem all creepy and scary.
No,
and he just like throws on these perfectly fitting black jeans and this shirt that he just conjured out of some magical fashion imagination land.
You know what he reminded me of? He reminded me of like if it was sort of like he sort of seemed like if. How do I put this? If Rick Ocasek was going to dress as Keith Richards impersonating Tim Burton, that's sort of what he looked like this morning.
And but not sickly looking.
No, but
like
I mean,
any
like,
of those three
and he
guys.
Had the thing of like, and he had the whole like, I mean, I wear a little bit of jewelry, but he had the whole like, you know, the like the arm full of like, you know, like the sort of heavy metal bracelet thing going on, and like the studded, and I swear to God, like where most guys would have like a handkerchief or a pocket square or something, he just had like a huge silver skull thing like hanging off his pocket, and then just like chipped black nail polish, and yet somehow. And I'm there literally like one step away from wearing a tux. I mean, I've got a suit on, and I just look like I fell off the rack at Kmart. It was just ridiculous.
By the way, Trent Reznor won. He and his writing partner won the Golden Globe for I think,
Social Network.
He got up and again, we all remember what Trent Reznor used to look like, the creepy goth like sleazebag
look
kind of
fishnets.
Look that he used to do. He now looks like your high school gym teacher that like was a football player in high school, and now he's just gotten beefy and has no neck.
Going to seed.
Yeah. That's what Trent Reznor looks like now.
Does he still have the same like that Moe haircut of his?
It's really, really short. Honestly, God, he looks like a high school football coach who like used to play football but couldn't make it like in the NFL, so now he coaches your high school team.
That's unfortunate.
And you shouldn't trust the babysitter at, you know, with him if he offers to drive her home.
I was talking to Gustav from KNRK about this a while ago, because, you know, he's very much he's one of the goths, and he very much grew up in that culture and whatever. And we were talking about aging goths and how that is more so than most subcultures. That is a thing where somebody needs to step in at the appropriate time and go, too old, you know, because you just, girls can make it last, you know, with women, if they know how to put themselves together, they can make the goth thing last, I would say, a lot longer than guys. There's probably a cutoff point for women, too, but I mean, they can sort of make it work in a sort of like Victorian kind of way. At a certain point, though, it's like if you are a male goth, like somebody needs to take your weird like pantyhose away from you and put you into something normal, like it just take you to the Gap, because it's over. You just can't do that.
Yeah, I was sort of goth before it was actually called that. It was more a matter of I was just sort of a drama and an
art, you were just depressed.
An art geek. I was just depressed. But it's like now that I'm getting older and I had, you know, taken on that sort of thing for a number of years, I will still indulge myself, as you know, with too much eyeshadow. But I had to accept a couple of years ago that the really dark lipstick just didn't work anymore.
Yeah.
Because I am really pale-skinned anyway. And there's this point where you just go, this was so cool when I was 26, and now I just look ridiculous.
Seriously. Because then you're just like one of those sad aging chicks who's trying to get people to go to a fetish ball with her.
Yeah.
You know, and she's like 50.
I miss the dark lipstick.
There's stuff that I can't. I mean, I had to reach a point where I had to admit that I was not Jimmy Page, and I was probably never going to become Jimmy Page. I mean, if you looked at me at any photo of me from like my sophomore year of high school on, you never saw a picture of me where I did not have an armful of what are those things? The bangles, the like silver bracelets from Claire's at the mall. Because I was just in my own head. I was just, of course I'm Robert Plant. And I just totally, you know, looking back, I looked retarded, I'm sure. But it was sort of, but that really was a thing where I felt like I was the coolest looking guy like on the planet, which is sort of enough for you at a certain point in your life. Like if you think you look cool, like you can almost, if you think you look cool at a certain point, that almost is good enough because that manifests itself in a certain, I think, kind of confidence where like, you know, especially if like, let's be honest, you're dating a bunch of teenage hayseed girls who don't know any better. You know, but you reach a certain cutoff age. Like, let's be honest, you reach a cutoff age where even if you are the actual Robert Plant, it doesn't really work anymore. So God for, I mean, so it's certainly not going to work for me. A couple people have said, by the way, it says, I don't even use a comb on my hair. I just wet down a wash rag in the morning and plaster it to my head. That is my dad's hair combing method probably to this day.
Hey, when I was during my punk rock period, when I had like, you know, a quarter of an inch in the back and then just long enough that I could like have it hang in my eyes or spike it up on top. That was one of the pluses of that was, yes, I could just wash my hair by running the washcloth over my head.
Somebody says, didn't I see Don buying some pants at a Costco recently?
No.
Okay. And finally, our friend Jenny says, I mentioned to Cheryl recently that I met Seth Aaron at a somewhat divey bar in downtown Vancouver. I was wearing jeans and a hoodie. He was wearing a bow tie and fancy pointed shoes. After talking with him for a few minutes, I said, do you always dress like this? Meaning so fancily. He said, what do you mean? This is how I dress. My point, Rick, is that no matter how hard any of us try, we'll never look as awesome as he does, so don't even attempt it. No, that is the yeah. thing that I... That's the. I told Cheryl last night, I'm like, hey, I just got a new shirt. Also, I got some of that summer bisque, which blends my imperfections away. And she just sort of chuckled sort of sadly. And she said, oh, that's so cute. Not going to work. And so I gave up. So that is coming up this Sunday, by the way. You'll be able to see Mr. Seth Aaron on Outlook Portland. And you can get that see that on our YouTube channel as well. Two other small notes here. Somebody says, speaking of the guy who needs to know when to tell it, call it quits, somebody needs to tell this to Timmy Ryan, who apparently... Was it you that told me that Timmy Ryan, who is now doing something over at Cascadia.fm?
He was in the building over there. I'm not sure what he was doing over there.
Flitting around like an angry moth.
We were told that, like, keep an eye out, Timmy Ryan.
Did they warn you?
They warned Bobby Roberts, because I guess there is some belief that there's a blood feud between Fatboy Roberts and Timmy Ryan, which Fatboy says it is not actually true. But Robert Wagner warned him as we were going up in the elevator. It's like, okay, just let you know, Timmy Ryan might show up. And we're like, okay. And then that was the whole conversation. So I didn't get a chance to ask why.
I don't think that there's any sort of a feud or a grudge or anything between Timmy Ryan. And I think it's really just between people and Timmy Ryan. It is just between Timmy Ryan and most of the Western Hemisphere. Yeah. And let's see. And final note. This is we started this conversation off like 9 hours ago talking about how things are suddenly, you know, things that used to have ingredients added are now infused and the internet is now the cloud. This is one that you hear in radio all the time. Listener Miguel says, don't forget, everything that used to be brought to you by is now powered by. That was the thing that we had at CBS all the time. You know, Rockfest, powered by Scion, which means nothing.
No.
It means nothing. There is no actual meaning to be found in those words. So, no, you are totally. This guy says, "I miss the constant good." I miss the good old days of the constant essing on Timmy Ryan. Well, those days could return. Apparently, he's back in Portland with his unbelievably tolerant or drugged girlfriend. You know, and looking for work, so we could send him to your place of employment, sir. You can find something productive for him to do.
Well, we were discussing the idea of getting the people in here that. That we want to limit the amount of time we're actually talking to them. You know, Dennis Pittsburgher, Brian,
well,
Myron
never
Beck,
met Timmy Ryan.
The people who are really super intense of just like having like a 15-minute shot clock.
And when it buzzes, they got to leave.
Yeah, get out. That's it. We have like this intense 15 minutes with them, and then it's like,
because
you gotta go.
We've discussed this before that you have never met Timmy Ryan.
No,
right?
I have never.
You've just heard about him. And it's like I made.
And I want Byron to come on. And every time I say I want Byron to come on, you just kind of go, like it just makes you tired.
I like Byron. I really do. I love Byron. He's great. He's one of our favorite people. I really dig him. But he's exhausting. That's the thing about Byron Beck. Is that like I have no problem with Byron at all. But he's just he you know what I mean. He's just so intense. And it's like being with Byron is like when he would leave the show finally, I would realize that I had just cinched up all my muscles, like I was just coiled with anxiety for however long for no readily apparent reason. Same thing with Dennis Pitsenbarger.
Well, I was in the studio with you and Dennis a couple of times,
God.
And you always looked like you were afraid he was going to lash out and just punch you or something. You would just kind of cringe a little bit and sort of back away.
I'd go into my happy place inside. I'd find what they call my center, and I would just hold on there. I would just be like, wait it out, run out the clock. So we talked about having Timmy Ryan. Everybody just hear me all the way through on this before canceling your subscriptions. We talked about having Timmy Ryan in the studio so you could see firsthand what people are talking about, but having literally setting a clock of like 15 minutes, and like at the end of the 15 minutes, like, you got to go. You know, like kicking it like Timmy's, you know, saying like, you got 15 minutes, but at the end of that, like, you're out, you're done. So I know we may do that at some point. Anyway, somebody asked about Ask a Juggalo, so we are waiting for a confirmation. We're trying to work out a schedule thing with our friend Chris the Juggalo, and he's going to be in probably next Tuesday, okay. We're thinking that. So we're waiting for a confirmation on that. So that's all of the way. I don't even know what the hell we're doing. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program, as it was an hour ago when we began. It's 503-505-6964. Well, without further ado, let's get a little bit of this so-called news done at the news desk. It's Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Federal health regulators are limiting a key ingredient found in Vicodin, Percocet, and other prescription painkillers.
Bastards.
That have been linked to thousands of cases of liver damage. Well, it is interesting. The FDA said Thursday it's going to cap the amount of acetaminophen.
That's Tylenol.
Yeah. At 325 milligrams per capsule. Current products on the market contain doses of up to 700 milligrams.
Wait a minute. So they're capping, you said, in Vicodin.
Right.
So they're not actually capping, like, the oxycodone part of that or whatever.
No.
It's just the Tylenol part.
Right.
This is like how they just want to remove the caffeine from Four Loko, not the actual alcohol, which is the thing that kills your brain cells.
Yeah.
Okay.
Acetaminophen is a ubiquitous pain reliever found in Tylenol, NyQuil, and thousands of other medicines used to treat headaches, fever, and sore throats. It's also used at larger doses in prescription combination drugs that mix it with narcotics like oxycodone. Those products are not dangerous by themselves, but can cause toxic overdoses when patients combine them with a second acetaminophen-containing drug like Tylenol. And that seems to be one of the problems, is that it's not really that it's in the drug.
Taking a fistful of it.
Yeah, it's that they don't really make it clear to people when they're taking these that this drug has acetaminophen in it. It'll say something. They'll use abbreviations like APAP. It'll say like APAP on it.
Okay.
And so then
they take it with Tylenol.
Then somebody will also take a couple of Tylenol with it.
Although if you're taking Vicodin and then you got to chase it with Tylenol, it seems like you've got larger issues, like you're on fire.
Well, I've also wondered. I also wonder just, I mean, they said that acetaminophen is the leading cause of liver failure in the U.S.
That wouldn't surprise me.
And I just wonder just like how much people are taking, though, that it causes that, because before I actually when I had bad hips and before I got hip surgery and before I got a prescription for Vicodin, for that matter, I was just taking fistfuls of Advil like all of the time.
Well, that's not acetaminophen, though.
They would also say ibuprofen was also supposed to be really bad for your stomach, really bad for your liver. And I never had any problem at all. And I was taking a lot.
One of the reasons that they introduced ibuprofen, most commonly found in Advil, is because that was introduced because acetaminophen was felt to be so dangerous. And and here's one of the other things they don't mention in this story, but this is a very real factor. One of the things they're not talking about is that Tylenol, at least for a long time, was used in suicide attempts. So they're probably – that is reflected in those numbers, although they're not making that point. That when they talk about it's the most widely it's the biggest cause of liver failures, a lot of those are people who either intentionally or accidentally – In other words, those people may or may not know that it affects your liver, but they do know on some level that it's dangerous. And so Tylenol was a thing. When I was – just in the time I was in like high school, I think four girls tried to kill themselves by taking Tylenol.
Well, it does say that acetaminophen is the leading cause of liver failure, sends 56,000 people to the emergency room annually. Yeah. About 200 of them die, and the FDA estimates 120 of those deaths are linked to prescription drugs with acetaminophen.
Yeah, and it is one of those things that there was a girl when I was, I don't know, I think in ninth grade, a girl named Maria who, blah, 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 despondent, blah, 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 boyfriend, and then went home and took a bottle of Tylenol. And I don't know whether she was actually aware that it was that dangerous or whether she just thought, hey, bottle of pills. And she, you know, it'll do something bad to me. And she put it down and she lived, but she actually lived with such a damaged liver that she then became one of those girls that they would truck around to high schools to talk about, because the thing was, the doctors told her, they said, like, you have so effed your liver. And by the way, you're not going to get a donated one because you took a big bottle of Tylenol. They said, you have so effed your liver that if you so much as get drunk, like, it could just turn your liver off for good. So, like, they're like, you cannot have any booze, like, ever now because your liver is just trashed. A lot of those are probably accidental, but some of them aren't. So that's one of the things that spurred the introduction of ibuprofen. I think about that sometimes, too, because, like, I never knew about that when I was – I mean, I guess it says in the bottle, like, don't take any more of these, but – you know, but it says that on everything. Like, don't take more than three, and it's usually crap. But yeah, I was like you were. I would just take, like, I would get these horrible leg pains, and I would just be like, well, if two is great, 12 is better. And I would do it like two or three times a day. And I kind of don't ever want to have the damage to my body inspected because I have no idea what I probably did to myself taking just fistfuls of Tylenol over the years.
I guess with this, it's not going to affect over-the-counter drugs because they're already under the limit that they're concerned about, but they're going to have order lower doses of acetaminophen in prescription drugs, and they're also going to start including strongly worded warnings in the pills and in the drugs and also in the boxes of over-the-counter things that have acetaminophen to let you know not to mix these things and not to keep bumping up acetaminophen.
It seems like they ought to just never mind. It doesn't matter to me. But it seems like there is some other way that they could deal with this. But again, the whole thing fascinates me of the the mixtures of drugs that are available. You know what nobody really talks about? You know what's a fantastic drug is codeine. Let's talk about codeine. I had some of those. What are they? They're like a super Tylenol. They're like a Tylenol that actually has a codeine component to it. It's a prescription Tylenol.
Like Tylenol number 3.
That's a fantastic drug. That's a thing that I strongly recommend to you if you are taking it under the care and supervision of a physician who has prescribed it to you. That's something there that'll cure what ails you or anything. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. By the way, somebody in this room who had unknowingly let his Ativan prescription run out and had never bothered to refill it because he didn't find it necessary. Managed to file an order to refill that the other day.
Oh,
I'm just saying.
Well, that,
not that you care about that in any way.
I wouldn't care about that at all.
In case you were worried that I, Rick Emerson, would not have access to the Ativan that has been prescribed to me.
And I have a doctor's appointment on Friday, at which point I will be talking over my prescriptions with my new doctor, and we'll probably come home with a refilled prescription with my giant bottle of Vicodin, just because I know you're fascinated by my prescription drugs as well.
That's fantastic. That's wonderful. That's great news. Here's Don Taylor.
Let's do our clown watch.
Here's your clown watch for Tuesday on the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
So here's my question for you. Do you want to hear the clown story that is just kind of creepy and scientific, or the clown story that is violent and funny?
I go for violent and funny.
Okay, we'll go with this one. A man dressed as a clown threatened to burn down a liquor store in downtown Austin on Friday, according to an affidavit. Ted Stewart, 44, became upset when a store clerk at Twin Liquors refused to sell him liquor because the clerk believed he was too intoxicated. Stewart threatened to return to the store, kill the clerk, and burn the store down. The store clerk called police and described Stewart as, quote, a rodeo clown transvestite, unquote. It said Stewart was wearing clown makeup and carrying a Mexican flag.
Please, 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 please. You're shaking your head like there are no photos. Come on, come on. All right, fine.
Austin police found Stewart walking towards a Texaco gas station, ostensibly, I guess, dressed as a rodeo clown transvestite.
And with a Mexican flag.
And arrested him. He was charged with two misdemeanor terroristic threats and public intoxication.
He was going to burn down the liquor store because they wouldn't sell him more booze.
Right.
When you say that he's a transvestite clown, what is it that led them to that conclusion? What are the pieces of evidence to?
I'm guessing he was dressed as a clown and maybe wearing a skirt. Maybe he had boobs.
Okay. Well, it is a he, right?
Yes.
So I guess maybe he would have been dressed as maybe just wearing ladies' clothing? So just dressed as he was a guy dressed as a female clown?
Or he was just dressed as in ladies' clothing and then had clown makeup on his face?
Oh, that's actually so much worse. Like the idea that it was a professional gag, like it was sort of like he was a goofy, sort of fun loving clown, not unlike he was the Milton Berle of the rodeo set, you know, was it Milton Berle that dressed up as Geraldine, or was that Flip Wilson?
That was Flip Wilson.
Who did Milton Berle dress up as?
I don't know who the character was, but he did put on a dress and lipstick.
He had a feminine alter ego.
Yeah.
Which is sort of weird when you think about
it. Well, yes.
Did you know that he and Frank Sinatra allegedly, this is just a story, that he and Frank Sinatra allegedly used to put on like ad hoc late night drag shows at this club in San Francisco?
I do know that Milton Berle is one of the two actors in Hollywood, well, three really, if you count Liam Neeson, who were supposed to be legendarily well endowed.
Huge penis,
yes.
Apparently.
That's the apparently, Milton Berle. Forrest Tucker, who you remember from F Troop,
yes,
was apparently enormous. That's what they say.
Really?
Yes.
James Woods too. I heard about
really?
James Woods. Yeah, it's
and in oh God, what is her name? The horrible supermodel who did the America's Next Top Model, but the Janice Dickinson. In Janice Dickinson's autobiography, she described her affair with Liam Neeson and said that she said, and I believe these are the actual words, that it was like he had an Evian bottle down there. She said,
"Wow." Good God. Okay. All right.
Why I read Janice Dickinson's autobiography, I'll never know.
No, but can I just tell you this? I know we're inside the Clown Watch, and I apologize to Cheryl. We're just going to get all this done in one, you know, one fell swoop here. Can I just tell you a thing? Here's the thing that happens to you if you're a guy. It is always, without fail, you will hear from, like, if you have, like, female friends or female acquaintances, you will always hear that, like, the worst guys in your sort of social circle or circle of friends, they're always the ones who just have it's like the Louisville Slugger.
Yeah.
Always. It's like
they don't think they need to bring anything else.
No, it's like, they don't have to try, don't have to have any, they believe that there's no personality required and they can just be jackasses. It's like you will know some girl, you know, some friend, and she'll dump some a-hole boyfriend. You know, that you have always known was great. And she will agree with you once she's dumped him. She'll, you know, and the conversation always goes something like, yeah, no, he was just a jackass and he treated me really, really badly. But I do have to tell you, you know, you have no idea. It was like a baby's arm down there. It was just amazing. You know, but other than that, he was a jerk. And you're like, thanks for sharing
that
with
me. I thought we were talking about them being a jerk in the sack, too, because that's the thing is that the thing I personally have found, and I know other women who have said the same thing, is some of the worst lovers we've had were men that were spectacularly well endowed.
Oh, and they just had to be there.
Yeah, they didn't seem – whereas on the other hand, men with less to offer often seem to, like, make up for it by being good in other areas.
Well, you have to compensate.
And the ladies like that.
Yeah, well, I think there's an equivalent, you know, in terms of women. It would be, I cannot believe I'm saying this, but it makes me feel awkward to have this conversation, and I feel like I probably shouldn't. So I will just say that.
Is this going to be the thing where guys say fat chicks are great in bed?
Well, no, I wasn't going to say that, but I was going to say, that there are different. That there are, and it really is just no one sort of rule.
I'm so grateful.
There are all kinds of attributes or types of women who I think guys then will ascribe various behaviors to. Mm. Some good, some bad. I don't think it's that simple. I mean, I know guys who have said that, but I don't think I don't think guys have like a one size fits all rule for that sort of thing. I think guys do identify various types of women, you know, and like whatever their response or lack thereof is likely to be. I will just say this, this is just me. I'm just saying my own experience. This is me, Rick Emerson, just speaking for my own self. I will say that like really, really like skinny chicks are, in my experience, that's just a whole lot of, I mean, it's like you might as well just be there like, you know, by yourself. I mean, really, there's nothing to recommend there. And I don't just mean like aesthetically, although skinny chicks are not my type. I'm saying like in terms of the actual, the interaction and the level of enthusiasm, there's just, You know, you might as well just be there with a rake.
And then it's like having sex with a bag full of antlers.
Yeah.
So, you know.
It's just like humping. It's like humping a whole bag full of pointy, cornery things. You know, and you're just like, why am I here? And also, you look like Macaulay Culkin. You know, and it's like there's just. No. We should end this.
We really got off the clown thing, didn't we?
What I was going to say about the clown is it's strange to believe that that's now the more tame area of conversation. It's one thing if it was, again, like a sort of drag queen clown as like a goof, again, like, you know, like a Flip Wilson sort of a thing. That, I guess, is weird, but it's, you know, I guess you can see they're like, hey, he's a clown. He's extra funny because he's a man wearing ladies' clothes. If it's a guy who's just a cross-dresser in a dress, then he just lathers on clown makeup, like as an extra sort of fillip on top of the whole thing. That then becomes creepy because I don't know why, but I keep picturing just Leatherface for some reason. Because there's that sequence in Texas Chainsaw Massacre where, if you watch that movie closely, one of the really disturbing things about that movie is that Leatherface doesn't just have the one mask. He has a series of masks that he wears at different points in the movie. One of them is like a lady's face that he puts on when he's making them dinner. He's like in the kitchen bustling around, sounding a lot like Julia Child, by the way, sort of a ooh, you know, and sort of, but he's got like this Lulu Hogg looking like mask on. It's like he took Delta Burke's face and put it on. It's so creepy. And that's kind of what I'm picturing when you talk about the transvestite clown. So, all right. We should just end this right here. Hold on. I didn't want to read this thing about the guy whose mouth wouldn't quit bleeding. All right. All right. I'll just get this done.
Every once in a while, I have one of those moments of clarity where I just go, this is what I've chosen to do for a living.
Yeah. It's kind of great, really, when you think about it. Okay. You do also just every now and again get a little bit of sympathy. Not a lot. A little bit of sympathy for like any of the radio stations that employed me over the years where at some point like a guy at a board of directors or whatever like had to justify the expense of hiring us to do a show where we would do this. I mean, this is what they got. They would pay us however much money a year and in exchange they would just get us talking about just drugs and clown sex. And putting on Delta Burke's face. And I mean, it's like, well, who pays for that? I mean, eventually no one, you know, I mean, except for y'all. And God bless you. Well, this guy just wants to tell you, he just says aspirin, by the way. He said another bad thing about aspirin. It makes you bleed uncontrollably. He says in November, I had a deep cleaning done on my teeth. A tooth was aching afterward. So I took 4 Bayer aspirin. And then I just started bleeding uncontrollably from the mouth. And then he follows up at a series, and these are all done as individual sentences, which makes it sort of great, like a sort of like Morse code, sort of like it's almost like a Western Union telegram, sort of started bleeding for 30 hours. Stop. My mouth just bled and bled and bled. Stop. And bled. Stop.
Yes, aspirin is a blood thinner. That's why one reason if you're going to go get a tattoo, for example, they ask that you not take aspirin for X amount of time before you go get a tattoo.
It thins your blood.
Yeah, it thins your blood.
Anticoagulant.
Right, right.
I'm going to read the worst thing, and so I'm giving everybody ample notice here. Now, I will also say this.
Now, this is the worst thing after we've already talked about a rodeo clown transvestite and Leatherface wearing a woman's head.
Delta Burke's face.
Delta Burke's face.
This is pretty bad, what I'm about to read. Now, I will also say it's going to be over in like 20 seconds.
Okay.
And how many times have you heard that, ladies? So I'll give you a little bit of warning. I'm going to read this in like 10 seconds. And so if you want to just turn the volume down, or maybe if you're listening to this on your iPod, if you want to skip ahead about 30 seconds from when I say now.
If you're at work and your boss is in the vicinity.
It's not sexual, I will say that. It's not lewd or prurient in any way. It's unpleasant, though. So if you'd rather not hear something unpleasant, and it seems highly unlikely you would even be listening at this point if that were the case, but, you know, what do I know? So 30 seconds from when I say now, you'll be able to tune back in, because I'm just going to read the most horrible phrase. All right. 30 seconds from now. He says, I eventually went to the ER because I woke up at 1:30 a.m. with a mouth full of blood and clots. So there you go. There's that guy. All right, that's awesome. Did we already close out the clown watch?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
We got another 10 seconds or so before people tune back in. Hold on. All right. Well, let's do what? Jesus, it's 2:40. What an irresponsible group of loons we are. All right. Well,
we spent like 45 minutes talking about Dan Clark's beard and your hair products.
Yeah, well, let's do one more here and we'll take a little break.
Oprah Winfrey, who was pregnant at 14 and lost the baby, saw the loss of the child as a second chance. In a wide-ranging interview that aired Monday during the premiere of CNN's Piers Morgan Tonight, she told him what it was like to be pregnant at that age.
I have to say, and I'm not trying to be... I know this. I'm not trying to be a dick when I say this. I don't mean for this to sound cruel. I really do mean this. That phrase, they got to find something more specific than that phrase, lost the baby, because that could mean several things. It's not like you left it like with your, you know, like with your, like when you returned it to Blockbuster Video or something by mistake. But I mean, that could also mean like that's the thing when I think people get the baby taken away. Sometimes you will have, you know, you'll have the kid and then the state comes in and the state says like you're not allowed to have the kid. And it's like it's the catch-all term. And then it makes you feel a little like you're uncertain, like you don't really know what they mean by it.
Well, yeah, I was talking to a listener actually at Aaron Duran's comic book thing. And we're talking and he said, we've met before. And I was like, oh, and I did remember. I said, oh, I remember us talking. You were having a hard time of things. He's like, well, things have been very good. I got my first girlfriend, then I lost my girlfriend, and then and I was like, oh, I'm sorry. And then I went, well, wait, what do you mean by lost
your girlfriend?
Like you broke up with your girlfriend, or you like lost your girlfriend, or you just lost your girlfriend? He's like, well, no. I mean, she was short, but I didn't just lose her. No, and it turned out that no, she
it was
didn't
a breakup.
Die, or it was a breakup. But I had that moment where I was just like, oh, well, that's too bad. Okay, wait a minute. Maybe I should be sadder about this.
What tone should I be using? Yeah. What emoticon suits this?
So let me dig further into your personal life, sir.
I'm sorry. So what is the setup for this Oprah clip?
This was Oprah talking to Piers Morgan about what it was like to be pregnant at the age of 14.
I knew that when I lost that baby, that for whom I had no connection to whatsoever, I would have to say. I was 14 years old and felt nothing but just, okay, relief, because I thought before the baby was born, I'm going to have to kill myself.
Wow. Well, I guess it's a relative win then.
And apparently she tried. Among the ways she tried to kill herself was she drank detergent, so which is something she told Piers Morgan.
I don't get the whole... I mean, you know, I don't get the whole thing of people trying to kill themselves and then they do it in some way that is almost certainly not going to be effective. And also it hurts.
Well, that's because they're not really actually trying to kill themselves. Usually they're trying to basically get someone to pay attention to how much pain they're in.
Is that the thing? Because like Billy Joel did the thing if like he drank a bottle of furniture polish.
Yeah.
And that just seems so unpleasant, like in a lasting sort of
yeah.
way.
Oh, yeah. No, ugh. It's just it's ill-conceived, but it's that whole if I do this thing that looks like a suicide attempt,
right,
and I make myself violently, horribly ill.
Stick me in a hospital somewhere.
Yeah, and then people will realize that I'm miserable and I need some help. Winfrey told Morgan she was sent to live with her father in Nashville when she was a young teenager. He laid down the rules of his house early and without knowing she was pregnant.
You're going to obey the rules. You have a 10 o'clock curfew. And I would rather see a daughter of mine floating down the Cumberland River, he said, than to bring shame on this family and the indecency of an illegitimate child.
Wow.
And he's saying that to me, and I know that I am pregnant. So I'm thinking, well, I'm just going to have to kill myself.
Now, wait a minute. What is it? I thought she didn't know who her father was. I thought that there was something where her father was unknown to her.
Yeah, I don't know.
Didn't there some, like, Kitty Kelly or somebody? It probably was Kitty Kelly. Put out a book last year about Oprah, and Kitty Kelly... who she came to prominence, she wrote about the Royals and about Frank Sinatra and was viewed as being kind of a hatchet artist in terms of biography. But she claimed to have interviewed Oprah's father, which was a little bit of a bombshell because Oprah said that she didn't know her father and didn't want to.
Yeah, and there was some stuff going on with him, this guy in Mississippi, having a claim to being her father.
Or maybe
and
it's
Oprah. I think maybe there might be some
dispute about who the father
right.
is. Okay.
Because yeah, there was a whole thing about this guy wanting to go through a DNA test, and Oprah saying, "No, screw you."
Because I guess this guy she's talking about here, this is Vernon, I think his name is Vernon Winfrey or whatever. And so that I guess is the guy that raised her, the guy that she grew up thinking was her father. And then, yeah, some other guy said, no, it was me. And I guess she was like, well, F that. Because I think she has what we might call frosty relationships with her family.
And I guess there was a lot of abuse.
A lot of raping by
uncles and stuff like that. So
don't you just figure that, like, every sweaty family in the South, that's just, whenever they talk about, like, you know, and there were some issues, you just go right to the raping. I mean, it's like that is, I mean, you know, that's
that are,
just.
That are just drinking way too much corn liquor and then causing brain damage.
You know, and the,
because like you, I have this image of the South as being nothing but like, you know, dusty dirt roads and broken down doghouses.
And just a guy running a combine somewhere.
Yeah.
Because it's like that thing of. There was this whole spate of, you know, I learned at a certain point, by the way, I talked about this, my wife and I have these sort of, we're sort of mirror, or what's the phrase, polar twins in some ways, that I really, really love bleak movies, or don't mind them at least, movies that are really just relentless downers. And she doesn't. She doesn't like movies that are just, that leave you just feeling, you know, like sort of like depressed at the end. Whereas I do not really care for depressing novels. Books, if I'm going to read fiction, I choose not to read something that is endlessly depressing. I mean, I will, but I don't really like, whereas that's all she reads. I mean, there was like this, and I don't think she picks them. I think she just somehow, they just find her. And they, when we first were together and we were sort of like, what do you read? What movies do you like? What's your favorite record? And she had me read like three or four things in a row. And I swear to God, it was like every single one of them was just a sweaty family in the South where somebody was raping somebody else all day long. Every, you know, and then stopping to have hush puppies. You know? And it was, and 90% of the time, the story was being recounted by an adult woman working in the publishing industry who was trying to come to terms with her broken relationship with her mother.
Oh God, did she make you read that?
Yes,
Yaya
yes,
Sisterhood
she did.
Book?
Yes, she did.
Oh dear God!
Divine Secrets of the Yaya Sisterhood.
I managed to avoid the book, but I had to go see the movie for work.
Yeah,
and oh my God, that was just infuriating.
That was actually the one
horrible.
That was the one that I was thinking of when I said that right there. But also see also Bastard Out of Carolina. See also. I forget. There was something else. It was by Margaret Atwood, who I actually grew to like quite a lot. I learned to like a lot of her writing. But it was really. It just seemed like everything she was reading at that time. It all took place in like a one room shack somewhere in Kentucky, you know. And it's like, you know, yeah, you know, and Dad like lost his limbs in a threshing accident, so he was at home all day with nothing to do but sodomize, you know, everybody else in the house, and you know, and then they would do, and then
which
they
is kind of hard to do when you've lost your legs.
Well, it takes some doing, and then they make it into a movie with Kathy Bates, you know, and somebody from the Gilmore Girls, and he would just go, okay, I guess this is what I'm watching. What was my point here? There was the other thing that happened around that time. So that was the trend in literature. And by the way, I think Divine Secrets of the Yaya Sisterhood was actually the second book in the series. I think there was actually one before that. I think Little Altars Everywhere was the book before that by Rebecca Wells or whatever her name was, who seems like a nice enough person, but goddamn. And so let me tell you this right now. If you ever really want something just to solidify your decision not to have children, just read some of that. I won't even call it chick lit, but read some of those books. Because really, they just paint parenthood and childhood as just, you know, just some of the worst hell on earth. And it really does. It really is just an underscore. Like every – you know what those books are? Those books are – they are very vivid depictions of the worst case scenarios I think that some parents-to-be paint in their heads about how they will feel about the kid once the kid is born. Because parents all have that thing of like, I don't know, I'm just afraid that once the kid is born, I won't love it. And, you know, and that doesn't typically happen. But every now and again, it does.
Yeah. Yeah, there's like these hormones and things to kind of guarantee that you do.
But every now and again, there's an aberration, right? And these books all seem to be drawn from that end of the gene pool. You know, it's all, it is like that 1% is extrapolated onto a whole shelf at Powell's.
My problem with that stuff is that as someone who came from a family where both my parents were just dicks, you know, in their own way. They were terrible parents and they were just, you know, just had no business doing it, really. And growing up and realizing how, like, to a certain extent, it wasn't their fault. I realize now that there was some craziness there that was not getting taken care of. And so, but I read these books, I see these movies, and the message that it always shares with you is that with understanding always comes love and forgiveness.
You'll learn to accept it, Don.
And, you know, no, and Yaya Sisterhood is especially one of those ones where you're just like watching this character played by whichever Judd that was, and how what a horrible, horrible alcoholic mother she was. And that, but, you know, Sandra Bullock's supposed to be all okay with it now by the end of the movie because it's her mom. And it's like, and I always am so angry by these things because I just go, screw that.
That was my thing with Laura. That was, I think, the breaking point.
Screw her.
With me just blindly reading everything she handed to me because I finished that book. By the way, who when we were just talking about clown raping or whatever a second ago and I don't know, and I don't know, and like guys with huge, huge wangs, who would have thought that just moments later we would be talking about Divine Secrets of the Yaya Sisterhood? That is the multifaceted nature of the Rick Emerson Show. That's texture, kids. But I think the moment when I just – and this is one of those things where it's like – I want to say it was a first fight, but it was one of those moments where we realized that like we could – we were probably going to get along for a long time because, you know, because there's that early stage of the relationship, you know, where, again, you're like, you know, you're sort of like comparing interests and whatever, and you at a certain point you start to diverge a little bit and you realize that, you know, there are things that you don't necessarily share in terms of interest, and that the relationship then only goes one of two ways. You either break up or you're in it like for the long haul. And I think we realized that it was like gonna, you know, that it was gonna be a serious relationship when we were able to have this sort of argument and then sort of, you know, and then kind of go on and be okay with it. But I just told her, I finished the book and I like threw it across the room and I was like, why did you have me read that? And she said, "Well, it's a great book." And I said, "It's not." And she said, "Well, what do you mean?" And I said exactly the same thing. I think the woman's name, her name is what the hell is her name? Her name is like Niecy or something. Is the mom? And I said, "She's a horrible mother." I said, "That's the whole point of the book, is that you're supposed to love and forgive a horrible parent who was irresponsible and was borderline abusive and neglected her children because she was selfish. Like, that is – she's an irresponsible parent who should have been sterilized. I mean, she should have had her children taken away and she should have had her vagina welded shut. Like, that's the lesson of the book." And she said, "Well, no, it's about embracing, you know," and I – no, it's not. But it, and I have to say that that is a thing – I hate the stereotype, but that is a thing that like – that so-called chick lit and movies made, I think, specifically for a certain kind of woman, they are – and guy movies, I guess, have some of this, but it is like women's films typically are replete with this intergenerational like forgiveness where at some point they're all in the kitchen together making a sumptuous ethnic dish and they realize they're not so different. And then you forgive your grandmother for branding you with a cattle iron or something, you know, when you were five. Well, she was a woman of her time facing, you know, challenges of her own. I'm like, all right. But my final thought, the reason we got off into this whole thing, I was just talking about all these sweaty, rapey books from the South, that those all seemed to come out like in the mid-90s. And that was also the period where there were all of these either documentary films or memoirs coming out. And they were all exactly the same thing. And somebody was really irritated at me when I made this observation. But I think that's because they realized it was true, that there was this whole spate of documentaries, and you probably saw any number of these, where there is somebody, usually a burgeoning filmmaker, who goes back and he releases a documentary which documents some horrible secret he uncovers in his own family. And I said, the secret is always incest, by the way. That's the twist ending. You know, that's your Kaiser Soze reveal at the end. It's incest because it's always incest. That's always the dark secret. When a family talks about they harbor a dark mystery from the past that will tear lives asunder, it's always incest.
Those are like capturing the Freedmen.
It's never not incest. And I'm not trying to make light of that or diminish that. I'm just saying that, like, that was a marketing shtick that was used by Hollywood for a while. And it's like after a certain point, like you just sort of like you've seen that story. But they sort of kept – then they waited a few years, then they brought it back with that Precious movie.
Oh, God.
Last year, which, you know, which is like the anti-date movie.
I think, though, that there should be an entire section at Powell's, though, that's just labeled sweaty, rapey books from the South.
Like the Tennessee Williams Memorial section. All right. Well, we should take a break because it's almost like 3. Thank God Greg and Sarah are already here today. Let's see. Still to come, we got your Geek Watch.
Everything.
Still to come, everything we promised earlier. It would be wrong to do a sponsor mention here. So we'll just take a little break. On the other side, we'll come back. We got all the other stuff to do. And we've got clue number 2 for round number 1 of version number 2 of Name That Snack. So that is all in the way. You're listening to the Rick Emerson radio program. Don't go anywhere. Back after this.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
I'm not known the darkness. none of the light. Were it not for gravity, there would be no flight. When I've lost the path, I would never find my way. An equal part my heart I gave to bloom and to decay. With a rattle and a grind, I find that I'm back at my favorite part. Well, I may not be your kind if your kind is made of heart. When the world is sick and tired and it makes you to fall apart. Maybe hanging by a thread, but now we're stayed on the art. Oh. I call upon my demons as I call upon my saints. I lend an equal ear to each and I suffer no complaints. When the fearless be your ushers and the shadows be your guide, the best way out of hell is through the other side. With a rattle and a grind, I find that I'm back at my favorite part. Will the midnight be your kind if your kind is made of heart? When the world is sick and tired and it begs you to fall apart. How far down you wanna go? We could talk it out over a cup of joe. And you could look deep into my eyes like I was a supermodel. Uh-huh, come on! So it's you and me, baby, no one else we could trust. We'll say nothing to no one, no how or would bust. And never crack a smile or flinch or cry for nobody. Uh-uh. I give your ID card to the border guard. Now your alias says your captain, Jean-Luc Picard of the United Federation of Planets. Cause he won't speak English anyway. Everybody knows that the world's full. So meet me at the mission at midnight and we'll divvy up there. Yeah. Everybody knows that the world's full of stupid people. Well, I got the pistols, so I'll keep the pesos. Yeah, and that seems fair. The sheriff's car and sausage up in his tires, and that won't get very far when they finally get the word that there's been a hold up. Uh-huh. Give your ID card to the border guard. Now your alias says your captain is Jean-Luc Picard of the United Federation of Planets. Cause he won't speak English anyway. Everybody knows
little ditty up there. And everybody knows that the world's full of stupid people. Well, I got the pistol, so I'll keep the pesos. Yeah, Nazis fair! Pesos. Yeah, Nazis fair. The Nazis fair. Nazis fair. Nazis fair. Yeah, yeah. Ha ha. I drove.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. It's 503-505-6964. Coming up here in just a bit, we'll have question number two out of five for this week for the... We shouldn't even call it the Name That Snack contest at this point, but the E.H. Vending...
Snack-a-braid-a-thon.
I was just going to say question of Vendorama-thon thing. In any event, so that'll be coming up here in just a few. Still to come, also Geek Watch, Snuff Watch, Religious Nutcase Watch, and the top five segments of songs, top five song portions to which everybody must sort of sing along as required by law. At the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
A woman in Britain who bought a singing toy puppy for her baby daughter said that she was left horrified when it started swearing. Lee McPherson, 20, of Banbury, Oxon, said the cuddly My Pal Violet toy started swearing when she pressed its paw to trigger its first song. The dog sang, "If you're happy and you know it, F with me. If you're happy and you know it, F with me. If you're happy and you know it and you really want to show it, F with me."
Did it really say that?
Well, she said she played it back three or four times, and there was no mistaking what the dog was saying. She later said, the toy is American, so the voice has a U.S. accent. They say it's actually saying bark, but to anyone in the U.K., it sounds like the F word. They are sending me another model they say definitely doesn't swear.
Oh, bark with me.
Yes.
Okay, so the bark with me and the F with me.
Bark with me. But I guess they're having...
I guess.
I don't see those sounding alike at all.
No. I mean, that's one of those things where you just... I guess the accent can sort of play a trick on your ears.
And Leapfrog Toys has apologized and said to avoid future voice misinterpretations, a new recording has been put into the toys that are on the shelves.
One of the more surreal moments, and this was... specifically at CBS, but it sort of happened everywhere, I would imagine. One of the more surreal moments after the whole Janet Jackson boob-bearing thing, when, you know, they just amped up all of the indecency laws, we would have stories like this where there would be, you know, and it's always a kid's toy, always, you pull the string and then Barbie says, go F yourself or whatever. And it's and the doll is never really saying that. It is always just I forget what the scientific term for this is, but it's some confluence of syllables that, you know... It's the new direction syndrome, where something can sound like something else. And we actually had like CBS lawyers at one point telling us that in cases like this where the doll was saying something innocuous, but that like if you heard it through a specific accent or dialect, you could reasonably construe that it kind of resembled another word, that we couldn't actually not play those sound bites on the air. This, by the way, was the same lawyer who told me that we were not allowed to play records backward if playing them backward would create something that might reasonably sound like a profane word. So, just FYI.
By the way, I'm fairly sure you don't watch Glee, but
no,
were you aware, though, that the Glee Club, the high school Glee Club on Glee is called New Directions?
Yeah, and I've sort of figured, I mean, not like I invented that, but I have always sort of figured that was, I mean, have they ever alluded to?
No, they've never.
Because it's got to be a joke. I mean,
yeah,
it's got to be an in-joke. Do they ever drop the phrase into an awkward context to underscore the joke?
I don't think so, no.
Don't you just...
It took like a full season before it really even occurred to me that they had done that.
Oh, yeah. See, and I guess maybe because I'm me. The first time I saw it, I was like, New Directions. Proving that not even I am immune to the joke's charms. But I have always assumed that was someone... And again, I'm not saying it came from the show, but somebody who noticed the same thing I did and went, I know what we'll call it. You know what I have... Here's the thing. And I know this is, you know, what I realized a few minutes ago is because now that Mad Men and Walking Dead and all of our shows are sort of done, you know, we could actually be doing on Tuesdays a house recap because, you know, I'm caught up with everybody else and I'm not sticking to my pledge to wait till the end of the season and watch them all at once. I'm just watching it every week like a commoner.
And I watch it every week. So,
so you watched it last night?
I did.
Well, we should. I don't know if we'll have time. We maybe do the actual recap like either later today or tomorrow even. But and then we could just do it because we're not even halfway through the season, I think. So we got like the rest of the season. I will say, this is not really about last night. I was, but that this prompted that observation that we should probably do a house recap each week. Something that I admire about that show, I was mentioning during Legion of News that they've never gone the scurvy route. They've never used that. You know what they have never done is they have never, and I don't know how many people even know this, but you know, giving him the name of Dr. House is an inside reference. That is an inside joke that they have never. And I was impressed because I thought that they would explain it like in the pilot episode. I thought that they would elaborate this. Dr. House, and I don't know if they still do this. They probably don't because of the show. At many hospitals, including the hospital at which my mother worked, Dr. House was the code word they would use for when a patient had died.
Oh, my God, that's right.
And they would say, paging Dr. House to room 622. And that meant that the patient in 622 had just died.
That's right.
And when I was in high school, a good friend of mine, her mom had cancer and was being treated at the hospital where my mom worked. And anyway, so we would have these long discussions about whatever. And she said that my friend's mom said that one of the creepiest things that she ever had to deal with was that somebody – she knew that at one point. Like somebody had told her or my mom had mentioned it, you know, at some point. But she said that she would be laying in bed in the hospital with cancer just like trying to, you know, like, well, this sucks, trying to get through it. And then every now and again, like a couple times a day, you would just hear the, Dr. House, room 432, Dr. House. And she said it was so creepy to hear a disembodied – and she's drugged up on painkillers half the time and sort of like stoned anyway. And she would hear this like spooky like voice from the heavens paging Dr. House, which is like Dr. Death, essentially, to whatever room. And she would – this is so horrible. She would have these weird waking dreams where she would hear them paging Dr. House to her room. And it was like – and she said it was just like – it was so unbelievably creepy. But so when I heard that like he's Dr. House, I thought, ha, that's so great. But they've never mentioned it. And I think that's kind of – that's sort of wonderful, actually, that they've resisted the temptation to ever explain that because that must – that can't be a coincidence.
No.
That has to be one of those things that they – it's like I think Polanek talks about this in one of his books, one of those things that when you're at stores and they page like Adam to the front gate or something. And that means that like somebody's trying to kidnap a child, so you got to like lock down the joint. And that's because of Adam Walsh. So that's stuff that is just creepy, and you kind of wish you didn't know it because then you just start to hear it everywhere.
Creepy in a completely different way. When Patrick was in the hospital, I was in the waiting room. He was getting some procedure, and all of a sudden, over the intercom thing, all through the hospital, suddenly this music played, going da 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 da. And that was it. And all of us in the waiting room just went, what the hell? And we looked around at each other like, okay, did you hear that? Did you hear that? And finally somebody, one of the volunteers or somebody said, that means a baby was just born. But it was so out of place,
yeah,
and so bizarre.
Because lacking context, it just becomes terrifying.
Yeah.
All right. Do not want. Have I played the news open? I have. We just did a news story
just
now.
News story.
Hey, hi. I've been here the whole time.
Do you have the sound for our
I do. I am
watch?
Ready.
Then let's do our religious nutcase watch.
Here's your religious nutcase watch for Tuesday right here in the Rick Emerson Radio program. In case you're wondering, this is the guy who now sings for Boston.
I was going to say, that chick has such a great voice.
Yeah, he's a pretty, pretty man, that Michael Sweet.
The latest in a bizarre series of animal deaths occurred on January 14th. The Wisconsin Rapids Tribune reported that the Portage County Sheriff's Department dispatched police to the town of Stockton after a cattle owner discovered numerous dead cows in a field. This says numerous other reports have said it was at least 200.
Okay, then.
The owner, whose name has been withheld by authorities, told deputies he suspected the animals died of IBR, which is infectious bovine rhinotracheitis, which is a respiratory condition, or BVD, bovine virus diarrhea, which is an illness that can damage a cow's digestive and immune systems. They've sent samples from the cow corpses to Madison to determine the exact cause of the 200 cows all dropping dead at the same time. Plenty of people are finding the herd's mysterious death somewhat apocalyptic in the wake of events that have claimed the lives of thousands of birds and fish in Arkansas and hundreds of birds in Sweden, Louisiana, and Kentucky. Some Christians, including online theologian Paul Begley from Indiana, believe the animal deaths were divined from above as a sign the end of days is approaching. Paul Begley does have a YouTube channel, and he posts videos to share with people all of the signs that he says God has given him personally.
Excellent.
About the coming apocalypse. Let's do O2.
I'm Paul Begley. Dead cows? What's going on? 200 dead cows in Wisconsin? Are you serious? Could this be real? Are you serious? Did this happen? Are you right with... Yes.
To whom is
over
he speaking?
Over 200 dead cows.
To me?
Yes. Fell over dead overnight in a farm in Wisconsin. Shocking the owners of the farm and bringing biblical ramifications of Bible prophecy coming to life right out of the book of Hosea in the 4th chapter. Can I read?
Yes.
God.
And then at that point, he reads from the book of Hosea, which is when man turns his back on God by swearing and lying and killing and stealing and committing adultery, they break out and blood touches blood. Therefore, land shall the land mourn, and everyone that dwelleth therein shall languish, with the beasts in the field and the fowls in the heaven, the fish in the sea shall also be taken away.
What the hell did the cows do? I mean, even if you assume that that's right, why would that just seems like God has terrible aim or poor eyesight or something.
Begley says that there's something biblically going on with the signs of the second coming of Christ. He has, like I said, a YouTube channel. And here, this, I believe, is him talking about some of his other prophecies he's discussed.
Did I not do a... You can look on my YouTube channel. I have a video about...
He knows we're watching the YouTube channel right now,
dead
right?
Dead birds.
Okay.
He has a video about dead birds.
And it's got over 11,000 views now since January 4th. I have another one about dead birds, dead fish, dead people, or something like that. It's got almost 9,000
like
views. I remember saying that God showed me in a vision after the dead fowls, after the blackbirds died and after the fish washed up, the Lord spoke to me as I was in deep prayer. And he said, woe, woe, woe. He told me that there would be beasts of the field falling. They have just fell. 16th day of January.
Yeah, okay.
Over 200 cows fell dead in one place.
How many videos does this guy have?
He told me there was
a lot.
Are there just dozens?
You could just, he's got a number of videos.
You know, the thing about the internet is that it's just...
And he looks exactly like you think he should look, too. He is a round-faced, pudgy guy with wireframe glasses in need of a haircut. And his videos are made on his laptop computer just talking into the webcam.
Does he sort of look like a I'm trying to think of who he might look like. Like maybe like an older, fatter Raider O'Reilly sort of a guy?
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, I figured he was either that or he would be like an underfed, like a DJ Qualls-looking kind of guy. The thing about the internet is that it's... I have this whole thing that the internet is like a magical mirror that shows you what you really are by dint of what you do and who you pretend to be and what you search up and what you download on the internet. All those things indicate what you really, really are. And the really unnerving thing about that is it indicates that like a massive percent, the massive percentage of the people on the internet are just flat out crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, and you never really had it. And it's sort of great for the rest of us because you never really think about all the entertainment, all the craziness that was just secreted away, like in fruit cellars and attics and nursing homes and pockets of America. We never got to witness before the internet came along. And now we've all been joined together. What is his?
There he is.
Oh, he looked much more respectable than I thought. He sounded even sweatier and crazier. But you can see, though, if you look at him, even just in that still, there's just like that. You can see the crazy just sort of lurking, you know, just like underneath, you know, just underneath the surface right there. Yeah, that's awesome. What do we do without guys like that?
I don't know. But so according to Paul Begley, guy with a laptop in Indiana, it's the end of days.
That's awesome. If you really want to amuse yourself, you should spend some time, just while away the hours, go online and watch the videos of people who want to tell you about how they've got Morgellons disease. That really is, I mean, that's...
Oh, that's that spiky hair growing in your skin
it's
thing,
where people
it?
Think they have carpet, like, growing out of their hands or something. It's awesome. By the way, sufferers include Joni Mitchell, apparently. So who you kind of knew was crazy all along. That really is just, that's some good watching right there. All right, that's your... Religious Nutcase Watch for Tuesday right here in the Rick Emerson radio program. Thank you for not saying a flockalypse, by the way.
Moopocalypse.
See, that's good. You know, it does. The beginning of that is especially interesting, too, when he does the whole, like, I can't quite tell if he's speaking to himself or en masse, you know, to everybody or to a specific person, or if it's just like doing a level check where he says, dead cows, can you hear me? Are you there? Am I right? Is this left? What is red? And he's just, you know, and he's just like sort of freestyling. I had something else I was going to say. Wait. Now it's gone. Here's Don Taylor.
Sarah Palin is being criticized for a 2010 campaign ad depicting Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords' district with crosshairs over it. In an interview with Sean Hannity on Fox News, Palin defended the ad in the wake of the Arizona shooting.
For many, many years, maps in political races have been used to target certain districts that people would feel that they can get into those districts and find someone whom they believe would represent the constituents' will better than an incumbent. And that is what this map represented.
You know, can you just... I was thinking about this the other day about the, you know, Sarah Palin and my whole thing that she's at this point anyway the presumptive nominee for 2012, and it's one of those things where, like, your brain almost, however viable you believe her to be as a candidate, your brain almost can't conjure up a future in which she is president. It's like my synapses just rebel at the notion of it. Like, I picture that thing they do on the documentaries with, like, the long sweeping camera down the hallway, and it shows all of the portraits from Washington and Adams and Jefferson and, you know, and it, all the way up to, you know, to George Bush and Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. And you're just trying to picture, like, her as the next oil portrait in the long line of succession. And it's like my brain just won't accept it somehow.
My problem is I really can't see her becoming president. I could see them maybe running her, but the more she's been in the public eye and the more she has been in control of her own boat, the more sort of frenetic and crazy-eyed and nuts she has seemed. And it's really, really hard to she is very much in control of her destiny and her people and driving her own bus. But also there is something that just becomes very, very shrill about her. Very
shrill is the word.
Very easily. That makes me think that, you know, it wouldn't take much to, like, just push her over the edge.
Yeah.
And the pressure of a full-scale presidential campaign would just make her just crack open like a walnut.
I can't even. I was actually not even thinking that. I was thinking, like, God, if she got into office— I mean, can you just imagine the, you know, just like the untold apocalyptic circumstances that, you know, and eventualities that might await us if she was. I was talking to my wife about this last night about, we were talking about Richard Nixon for some reason. We were talking about, I don't know, having a lighthearted discussion about corruption in the American sociopolitical system and whatever. But I was noting that, you know, Richard Nixon was almost, it was because I was just reading this book, this book called The Corruption of Power, and it was all about tracing Richard Nixon's whole political career as a series, basically of like crimes and outrages. And that when you look at Nixon, the amazing thing is that he was just almost comically evil. I mean, he was for all intents and purposes like a stumbling boob of a sociopath. I mean, he just had like no moral compass whatsoever. He was just completely and totally broken.
But also politically, though, at this point, compared to the Republican parties we've got today,
a genius.
A genius and a liberal.
Yeah, and just
an environmentalist.
But the thing about Richard Nixon is it's so fascinating is he did have these great moments where he like brokered a sort of detente with China, and he did. Richard Nixon actually created. I mean, the Environmental Protection mm-hmm. Agency came into existence under Richard Nixon. Yet at the same time, like there are these Watergate tapes. They did this study one time about things that like people will stop on if they are flipping by, if they're channel surfing, images that will make people stop what they are doing and stay on the channel for a second. And it was things like, you know, it was like women in bikinis, and one was like Hitler or something, and another was like Elvis, and one was like a dog and a puppy. And but for me, if I go by and there's any sort of like Nixon or Watergate, or if it's like that
for
graphic,
many many years,
the
snaps
hell, she can't
many...
be stopped. There's that graphic they always use.
Stop talking about Nixon. Talk about me.
There's that graphic they always use where it's like Nixon in the corner, and then there's the overlay, the bad animation of the tape reels spinning, and then just the transcript of the Watergate tapes as you're listening to him talk about, like, you know, he's a Jew, we've got to screw him, or whatever. But there's this fantastic conversation that you almost can't believe is real, where he's talking to Henry Kissinger, who was the Secretary of State at the time, and this is, I think, in 72, and they're discussing what they can do to really, like, ratchet up the death toll in Vietnam, because there's not enough people being killed. And Kissinger at one point on the tape, and you can go read the transcripts of this, Kissinger says, well, I believe we could drop some bombs on these dikes and the dams that they have, and we could flood the low-lying plains, and that would drown a great number of people. And Nixon says, how many people would that drown? And Kissinger says, well, it would, Mr. President, it would drown 200,000 Vietnamese, probably. And then Nixon just says, he leaps right to, what about a nuclear weapon of some kind? And Kissinger, you can just like hear it. Kissinger goes, I don't know. That is a bad idea, Mr. President. I do not think. And Nixon presses him on it and says, you don't think we should use a nuclear weapon, Henry? And Kissinger says, no, I don't believe we should do. And then Nixon's response is, come on, I'm just trying to get you to think big here. And it's like, who is this? And you think, oh, my God, he was our democratically elected president. He was a guy that won 49 of 50 states. I mean, he was almost comedically corrupt and violent.
The Nixon Presidential Library in California is like, I think, the gold standard for presidential libraries and museums. Everything should be based on this because the thing that did him in was that he saved everything.
Oh, yeah.
And so he saved everything.
Yeah.
And you can go see it and you can hear it. And there's an area that you go to and there's buttons that you push and can listen to clips from the tapes. And they have pretty much every single photograph of him that was ever taken in an official capacity. And they're on file and you can order a copy of it. You can pay $5 and get a copy of it. The most popular one, of course, is him with Elvis.
Right.
But the scary thing is that, yeah, not most of those clips of those tapes are not complimentary.
No.
But they're all there because this is his legacy. And so then you listen to these things about what a horrible, evil, crazy man he was. Then you go into the gift shop and you can get like golf tees with his signature on them.
No, it was you watch the Futurama depiction of him, and it's just not that far off from the reality. And the best thing about Nixon to me is not just that he was taping everything. It's that he had it installed and then forgot about it. Like he just sort of like it, you know, it's like it was like a set it and forget it kind of a thing. And it just never occurred to him as he was talking about it. We got to kill Jack Anderson, too. Let's cover his steering wheel with LSD, you know. And it's like nobody at any point, there was no like, you know, attention shoplifters, you are being filmed sign that they felt like they needed to hang up in the Oval Office.
And it never occurred to him at any point afterwards to go, Jimmy, that last 10 minutes, just burn that.
Take that home with you. And just toss it in a dumpster somewhere. All right. Well, in any event, so yeah, so that is sort of the good news, bad news about Sarah Palin is that, you know, if she were to be elected, I would imagine that there's probably some sort of horrible, fiery death awaiting all of us. But, you know, but it may not get that far because she might just completely and totally melt down during the campaign. Don't you get the sense, though?
Also, I mean, let's face it. If the Democrats do decide to play the same kind of politics that Republicans do, which they won't, but if they wanted to, how many skeletons do you think there are in that closet?
Oh, just an untold number. I mean, it would just be. Don't you get the sense, though, that people who, I won't even say people who like Sarah Palin, that people who hate Barack Obama or who hate what they perceive to be liberalism or, you know, whatever. Don't you get the feeling that they would just dig in their heels and vote for Sarah Palin out of spite, just out of pique? I mean, because if you think about it, I mean, and I hate to – I apologize in advance to our many rational and balanced and religious listeners. But we all know that certain – that type, that stripe of religious person, often but not always Christians, who when challenged on the logical underpinnings of their beliefs – their response is to just become immediately like more defiant and obstinate about it, as opposed to just saying, well, look, like that's what you think and this is what I think. And hey, what are you going to do? Big world. You know, they just immediately they like go to like the scorched earth policy of just completely like becoming intractable about it. And whatever doubts they may have vanish. It's like nothing will make them more secure in their beliefs than your questioning of the beliefs. So I get the sense that like if you if the left came out really hard against Sarah Palin in the election, that it would immediately just galvanize anybody who was not on the left into supporting for Sarah Palin. That it was to unify this base, however much they secretly feared or loathed her. So I think that that is the thing that people are not really considering. That like my in-laws will do whatever the opposite of Barack Obama is, you know, like whatever's on the other side of that line, that's what they'll support. It doesn't matter how crazy it is.
And can justify, you know, all kinds of stuff. You know, it, again, any dirty tricks could backfire. Like, you know, if it really is true, as is believed by many, I don't know if it's true or not. I don't even think I believe it. But that her youngest child is actually
right.
Her grandchild.
Yeah.
You know, if that came to light, probably about 99% of the people who already like her would go, well, good for her protecting her daughter's reputation.
They would
like
find
that.
A reason. They would find a justification.
Because that's
for
what
it.
Family does.
Yeah. I mean, that is the thing. It's like there's just, and I'm not saying liberals are any better, but there's just no arguing with certain people. Like there is no convincing anybody of anything when it comes to certain issues. So,
well, we have one more clip
so
of her
exciting.
That she's been defending herself against critics who have suggested her political rhetoric and use. Any use of the map may have contributed to the shooting.
That came up right away that, oh, it must be a cause of this horrendous evil act of this shooter that perhaps he saw that map and that incited him towards violence, which, of course, is ridiculous.
I have the same problem with her that I had with George W. Bush. It's not even fundamentally for me, it's hardly even about politics. It's the fact that I don't want the leader of the free world to be someone who can't talk.
Right.
If we're going to send this person as a representative of our country to foreign dignitaries.
It's embarrassing.
And to meet, you know, the heads of other nations. Can we have someone who knows how to talk?
Yeah. And it's like, well, it's like what my wife would call like the embarrassing boyfriend syndrome, you know, where you're just like dating some rube. You know, and you're meeting your friends or whatever, and he opens his mouth and he says some yokel idiot thing, and you're like, oh, Christ, I got to dump him as soon as tonight is over. whenever I see Sarah Palin or you know, George W. Bush for many years attempting to be smart in public and failing, it's like we'd go out to dinner, you know, when I was a kid, and like we'd be at Sizzler, and my dad would do the thing of like sniffing the cork on the wine, swirling the wine around in the glass, you know, and just going, very good, sir. I will take this vintage, you know, and it's like you're just wanting the floor to open up and swallow all of you.
The all-you-can-eat shrimp, if you please.
Yeah. Garçon, you know, and you're just like, oh, kill me. You're just praying that something in the food just immolates your insides. So that is, you are totally right. Because you know that, like, that's what the rest of the country goes like, you know, 280 million people. They pick that. You know, that's who represents them.
That's why all of Europe, you know, looked at us during the Bush years and just went, oh, God,
yeah.
you backwoods idiots.
Well, isn't that the thing with Obama, though? Like, as soon as Obama was elected, you're like, oh, thank God. I just, like, you just felt, for once, it was like you just didn't have some colossal boob out there representing you. You know, it was just, It was like we had all hired just Super Dave Osborne to be our to be our proxy, but not even that cool. So, goddamn. All right. Well, there you go. Was that a watch of some kind, or was that just Palin idiocy?
That was just Palin idiocy.
Well, we got to do a Palin watch at some point. We got to come up with a theme. Hey, something else we got to do is we got to. Now I'm just playing the bed to screw with you almost. We'll get to our second clue for the E.H. Vending Snack-a-Winner Prize-a-thon thing here in just a few. I do want to mention Squires Electric, one of our fine business partners who helps to make this program possible. Everything from top to bottom in your house or your business, whenever it comes to wiring and it comes to updating, to installing, if you're going to be getting a brand new building and taking it over, if you're going to be building a new house, you're going to be remodeling an old house, if you have something that was built, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100, 150 years ago, and you want to make sure that it's going to work properly, even if it was done within the last few decades, just things have changed so massively in terms of the amount of electricity your house probably consumes, the type of appliances you have, the electrical system you're going to need to support all of your computers, and of course the Ethernet wiring, everything you're going to need for your broadband access. And that's the thing you don't want to. And if you're going to be building a house, especially you're going to be remodeling something, or if you're going to be moving your business to a new facility, what you don't want to do is just spend all that money and then just skimp when it comes to the electrical system, which you're going to get screwed on that in 5 years. You're going to have to go and remodel and revamp the interior of all of the walls and everything that has to do with the electrical system at that point. Or if you've got a business, the next time the state comes through and they inspect things, you don't want to have to worry about whether or not you're going to pass the inspection. You want to make sure that it's done correctly and it's done right the first time. You contact Squires Electric at 503-252-1609. That is 503-252-1609, or go to SquiresElectric.com. We've already heard from people who've had Squires Electric come to their homes, and in at least one instance, I think we heard from somebody just the other day when we were down talking. I guess we were talking to, was it you that was with me, or was it Cheryl? When we were down actually talking to the folks at Squires Electric, and they said that they had had another referral. There was a business that had had them come out.
I think that Cheryl was with you.
Yeah, and somebody had heard us talk about Squires Electric. They were going to be moving, just what we talked about. They were going to be moving into a brand new building. They had been in one facility for 25 years, and they were going to be upgrading and going to a bigger place. But they had to make sure that everything was going to be up to code, because the city comes through and they inspect that stuff. And you want to know that it's done right the first time, because otherwise it slows you down, costs you time, costs you money. So you make sure that it is buttoned up, like right out of the gate. You make sure that it's taken care of. 503-252-1609 is the phone number, or you can find them online at SquiresElectric.com. That is SquiresElectric.com, or 503-252-1609.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Indeed you are. It is 503-505-6964. Join us tomorrow when our guests will include Ms. Kelly Clark from Willamette Week. Thursday, we'll talk to Anna Griffin from The Oregonian. And coming up this Friday, Big Jim Willig with another installment of Humor Me, Comedy 101. By the way, I don't know if I have time to talk about it now. I didn't even mention this thing. Did I tell you about this, the Twitter message that went up this morning? This is why I love the internet. A guy who just said, LOL Trunk Pizza.
You did mention that, yes, indeed.
Without any sort of context, so you and I know what that means. The people who were listening yesterday, they know what it means. If anybody else who's following that guy has they have no idea what that's even in reference to. To somebody, though, who did email this morning, they asked, yes, the trunk pizza is all gone. I have consumed it. I waited until my wife was asleep last night, and then I did sidle out to the car.
Seriously?
By the way, look, that's $12 worth of pizza. I'm not going to, I'm going to throw it away? I didn't want you to throw away a McRib that was 12 days old. That pizza was less than 48 hours old, and look, it's fairly chilly outside.
That's true.
That slows down your rate of food decay. Mm-hmm. So I'm not like Sarah Dillon, some weak-ass immune system. I eat something and then I'm just spewing out of both ends. No. Rick Emerson, he has an immune system of case-hardened steel, Don Taylor. Although I do have to say, and not just because of the guy on Facebook who occasionally just posts updates about what I'm doing at my home. just because we talked about it yesterday, I did actually do the thing because it was, maybe 1 a.m. and I was prepping for the Seth Aaron interview.
Creep out like a cartoon character. Look both ways. And
I did, in fact, skulk out under the cover of darkness, Don. Because I was feeling a little peckish.
If you had a soundtrack, it would go ding, 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 ding. As you tiptoed down the street.
Exactly. Like a really, really slow version of the Inspector Gadget theme as I sort of creep out from behind a rose bush. But it was 1 a.m. And it's like, Brotherman typing. That takes you got to have carbs for that and lipids and so forth. So I was like, I wonder how much of that pizza is left in the trunk of the car. I better check. So I, but after having talked about it, I swear to God, I did in fact open the door of the house, and I did the thing of like leaning my head out, sort of like Ren Hoek, you know, and just sort of like peering around, and then just walking to the car, and I did like an exaggerated yawn, like a. I guess I'll get this, you know, I guess I'll get this, I don't know, this this bottle of 1040 motor oil out of here and this sweater.
Oh, what's this?
I guess this pizza, which I'll put inside the sweater. Also, this box of papers that I need for something inside. So there were four pieces left, and they were fantastic, by the way. A couple minutes in the toaster oven, good as new. So just nice. FYI, in case you were wondering. I have time to talk about this thing I did with the car repair over the weekend, which is actually so notable that I will get to it, like, tomorrow or something.
Okay.
But, all right.
I need to do the snuff watch all before right. we get to the top five.
Here's your snuff watch for Tuesday on the Rick Emerson radio program. I will say that however stealthy I was on my way to the car and back, you know who I could not fool was Max, because it was that thing of like I opened and it, like, he must just – I don't know if it's like a sense of smell or if he just like – if I have some sort of like a – I don't know, some sort of a tracking device that he's put on me like while I slept or one of those things from Aliens that tells you that the aliens are in the room.
Well, you know, dogs are very good at reading body language. You
Is
may
that
have,
true?
You may, yeah, that's how they get most of their cues from us. So yeah, so you may have some special body language that you have when you're, like, on your way to get an illicit snack.
So it's like I have some way of indicating deceit, like imminent food-based deception, because it's like – and again, it's like 1:30 in the morning. It's pitch black outside, more or less. I'm creeping to the car, opening the car trunk. But it's like then I just look up at the house and he's in the window staring out at me with like just an absolute like the most intense gaze ever, sort of like, what are you getting? Aha! I knew it. So you know, and then I had to bribe him with like a little piece of pepperoni to keep him quiet.
Bella knows what a pizza box is because she always gets bits of what we call pizza bones, the crust at the end, and so and say, you want a pizza bone, and then we do the whole thing of making her sit and
right.
making her bark, that sort of thing. So now at this point, whenever we get a pizza, as soon as she sees the box, she's like, and smells it, of course, too. It's like, pizza! I get some of that.
Meanwhile, Philo just sits there and stares at the ceiling for like an hour for no reason. Can I tell you, my mother-in-law has taught, Lara's mom has taught their new dog, and I think she's done this with all of the dogs that her family's owned, has taught the dog the most morbid trick.
Excuse me.
Is it the Bob Newhart show already?
That's my phone ringing.
Okay.
I'll turn that
Wow. That was just weird. That was like another decade just sort of intruded on us, like two combs interlocking.
It's sad how excited I was when I saw that I could have an actual old style telephone ring as a ring on my phone.
No more sad than that. I immediately had like a sitcom opening running through my head. What was I saying? Oh, just that she taught her dog the most morbid trick when we were in Provo. She's like, "Hey, Lara, watch the trick I taught the dog." And she looks over this dog, and she just makes like a finger gun, and she goes, bang, and the dog falls over.
I taught Bella that. I taught her basically three different variations on lay down.
Uh-huh.
One is bang, and that's lay down really fast. And the other one is if I go, incoming, and she just like hits the ground really fast.
That's fantastic. See, that's
and
great.
Bang and incoming are essentially the same thing.
I don't know why it is that bothers me less from you. I guess it's to be expected, maybe. Contextually, it all makes a kind of sense.
And of course, I'm very disappointed with her when she doesn't hit the ground really quickly. When I go, bang, and then she goes, okay,
fine.
I'll lay down. It's like, I'm sorry, that's not how dead dogs fall to the ground. That's not good enough.
It's not like a slow, like, you know, where you're careening around the room knocking things over before dying of blood loss.
Yeah, it's not a Paul Rubens and Buffy the Vampire Slayer thing, although it'd be cool if you could teach your dog to do that.
Ah, you should totally do that and then take it to a con of some kind. All right.
Snuff watch.
I think I played the thing.
You did?
Yeah.
Don Kirshner. The music producer known as the man with the golden ear. He managed the songwriting talent that helped make The Monkees a TV series and produced ABC's Don Kirshner's Rock Concert.
How did I not know that?
I don't know.
Wow.
He died of heart failure at 77.
Wow, I had no idea. Boy, what a legend that guy is.
He was instrumental in the careers of singers like Bobby Darin and Neil Diamond, and singers as varied as Elvis Presley and Frank Sinatra recorded his songs. He had been inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame in 2007.
And he was, you know, he was an amazing songwriter and an amazing producer and was known for working with a lot of teen idols, most notably helping to create The Monkees. And he was one of those guys that, like, he was there sort of at the changing of the guard, because not that, you know, prefab pop acts ever went away, but he was, you know, there when they created the Monkees, helped to craft their image, helped to craft the music. And then when the Monkees sort of rebelled and decided that they wanted to write their own stuff and they wanted to produce their own records, he was one of those guys that was like, you know, you got a good thing going here. Why are you going to screw it up by writing your own material? And he wanted to just kind of keep the money conveyor belt going. And, you know, the Monkees, you know, they wanted to kind of be masters of their own destiny, whatever. And it's, you know, so he really like fought with those guys and had a huge turf war about it, but then went on to do, you know, to manage other people. But it was just a
and
guy.
And Don Kirshner's rock concert
was fantastic,
hugely influential.
Massive.
Absolutely. It was such just a cultural, you know, thing.
It was like the Midnight Special. It was like one of those shows that, everybody watched and everybody was aware of it. I mean, his influence on music is huge. And, you know, and again, you know, whatever anybody wants to think about him helping to create a prefabricated pop group, he had such a the man with the golden ear, which I don't think I've ever heard before, but it was certainly true because he was one of those guys that could just hear a single. He would just hear it and he would just say, that's your single right there. This is what, you know, that's a million selling record. And it was true. Like I think the story goes that he was when they were getting ready to do the first Monkees record, and of course they were picking out the songs like long before the group was ever selected. And they were in a room, and they did then what country guys do now, and what you'll hear like hip hop guys do now. Like you'll get you'll see a guy like Jay-Z, who he writes all his own rhymes, but then of course they bring in the producers to write, you know, the beats, as they say, the music. And you'll see these guys like a Jay-Z just sitting in a room with like a Timberland type, and they'll just play nothing but instrumental hooks over and over for hours. They'll be like, here's hook number 75, and they'll just play some sort of a beat, some sort of a track, and they wait until they hear the one that jumps out, and they go, aha, that's the thing to go underneath the lyrics. And country guys will do the same thing, where they listen to demo tapes all day waiting for a hit. But that all really started with guys like Don Kirshner and the Brill Building guys. But I think he heard Last Train to Clarksville. And it's like they got halfway through the first chorus, which I think actually happens at the beginning of the song. I think the song starts with the chorus. And they got like three lines in, and Kirshner was like, that's it. He's like, that's the first single. That's a gold record.
Well, that's the thing that a lot of people don't appreciate about the Monkees either, is they had amazing songwriters that would do that. I mean, you know, Jerry Goffin and Carole King,
Neil Diamond.
So Don Kirshner also responsible for the Archies.
That's true.
And Kansas.
Really?
Yeah, Kansas was on his record label.
That's interesting. I didn't expect that to be on there. I didn't know that. I guess it makes sense that he was the guy behind the Archies because, you know, that was he again. It all kind of came out of that same bubblegum mold that he was so responsible for. Wow, I didn't. How old was he? Does it say?
He was 77.
Well, you know, good for him. Good long run there. Excellent. There you go. There's Don Kirshner. There's your snuff watch.
Seven and living in Boca Raton.
Oh, see, that's how you want to go out, baby. That's how you want to live. I mean, right? I mean, it's like if you got to die, you're going to be nearly 80, richer than God, you know, and living in Boca Raton and just sitting there every day looking out of the sunset and just going, I am a god. You know? I mean, it's like the space cruiser Yamato guy that died a few months back. And he died like on a massive, I don't remember how many football fields it was, but died on a huge yacht called the Yamato that was like on some weird, awesome, like, science discovery voyage, and also probably filled with like chicks in bikinis. And I think he was just drinking champagne and fell off the yacht and like hit his head and died at the age of 85. And you know, that's really, I mean, if you have to go, that's how you go. Hey, speaking of Don Kirshner and the Archies, so we should take actually this moment we'll have to come up with some different name for the actual contest, but this is the contest formerly known as the Name a Snack contest. You had some huge
snack or braid-a-thon. No.
Braid-a-thon?
You know, as in, I got that. There was a, when I was a teenager, there was some car dealership in Los Angeles, and they had their yearly thing, and they were calling it their Sale a Braid-a-thon.
Oh, as in braid, not yeah, braid, in, like hair
in,
braiding.
No, as in celebrate.
Ah,
and,
I see.
And that was one of those confluences of words, Sale a Braid-a-thon. that has just stuck in my head forever.
I see the huge teeth of Cal Worthington behind that.
Man.
So this is brought to you by EH Vending, ladies and gentle persons. EH Vending. If you're not happy with your current vendor, if you never really see your current vendor, then you got to ask yourself the question, why stay with them? The answer is you don't need to. You can contact EH Vending at ehvending.com, or you can call Josh at 360-816-1853, or James, who is the sales manager, 503-897-8204. So if you're somebody that just, you want to find a way to keep, to toss a bit of a candy-flavored bone to your employees, or if you just got guys who are just, it's like they get hungry, they got to leave, and it takes time out of everybody's schedule, or if you yourself, if you're just a fan of things that are shaped, like triangles and taste like hamburgers, then by God, you got to ask yourself, why have you not contacted them already to have a machine put into your place of business that dispenses those items?
Well, it's not even that. I mean, we got our big box of snacks, and among them, a thing of oatmeal, a thing of instant oatmeal. So you could have your employees...
A little breakfasty item.
Get to work sooner and have a healthy breakfast.
And have more energy.
Right.
More energy so they can work for you longer.
And make you more money.
That's right. More hours for less pay because you're giving them oatmeal. And so it seems like a bargain, right? It seems like, you say, that's how you could probably... Really, if you were a shrewd negotiator, you could probably, wheedle them down a bit on the hourly wage by saying, but look at all this oatmeal. And then you just give them sort of a fixed stare. And then it doesn't work. Just occasionally go like, ah, and then, whatever. Can I just tell you, I have no idea why I said any of that just now, but I had the most amazing thing out of this. This sounds strange. I had the most amazing thing out of this cardboard box in the corner of the room. This magical giving box.
Well, you eat trunk pizza, so why not?
This box is sort of like... This box is sort of like Jesus on the Mount. It multiplies,
I refuse to interact with that box anymore now that I am not eating delicious snack foods.
It was sort of like there was a...
It was too much. I was eating nothing else because everything in it is so good.
I just don't even know. It seems like the box never... It seems like the amount of things in there never actually goes down. No matter how many people... Like Ryan White, who gave it, thank God the box is still here. And then Aaron Duran, who was in for the ailing Sarah Dillon. Sarah Dillon, ironically enough, out with food poisoning, Aaron Duran just sat here and just like stuffed himself like he was some sort of like he was some sort of a reverse vending machine, just feeding things in all the live long day. But the box, the contents never seem to get any lower inside. So it's, I don't know, it's like some
maybe
sort of...
Maybe that's the magic of EH Vending.
It's a candy-flavored fishes and loaves sort of thing. I had the most glorious snack food from there. I almost saved the wrapper so that I could buy more of them, and then I realized that was probably a bad idea. But it was like... I don't even know what they're called, but do you know those like sugar wafer cookies where it's like, it is the sugar wafer with the little cream filling between the two? So it was like that. It was like two of those wafer bars put together, but then in the middle instead of icing, it was like a thick layer of creamy peanut butter, and then the whole thing was dipped in chocolate. Oh my God.
That sounds wonderful.
Oh my God, you have no idea. It was so good. Here's how good it was. And by the way, you can have your machine stocked with nothing but this, if that's what suits your fancy. Contact ehvending.com. If we ever get one of those vending machines here, there's going to be a whole row of those things. It was so good. There are three of those bars inside. I took a bite out of bar number one, and I said, there was actually no one in the kitchen. I was entirely alone, but I actually said, oh my God. And I actually, I stopped. I almost... If it would not have been so horrible, I would have removed the bite from my mouth to save it for later, but I didn't. But I carefully closed it up and I put it in my bag, and I actually stopped by the store on the way home to purchase milk to consume with it once I got home, because I was like, this is so good, I can't not accompany this with milk. So that's what I do when I'm not eating pizza out of my trunk, by the way. In any event, but it was like a weird peanut butter wafer chocolate that was it was from like Mr. Flesner's House of Fun or something. That was like the name of the company. It wasn't from Frito-Lay. It was like,
Was it Q Bell?
It was no. The name of the company was Freshly's.
Freshly's.
Freshley apostrophe S. Apostrophe.
Wow.
Freshly's, and it was a chocolate dipped peanut butter wafer snack bar.
Is it Mrs. Freshly's?
Maybe. Do you have a picture of the item?
Not yet. I just found a website for Mrs. Freshly's.
And the thing about the wafer bar is that it was not so much a wafer bar as it was like a waffle, because it had like little indented squares of goodness and fun and lard. It was so great. I can't even.
Let's see.
It's actually, my mouth is actually literally watering right
that's
now. I'm having a saliva issue just describing it. It was so good.
I don't know. I can't find it.
Seriously, it's all I can do right now not to go just paw through that thing like a raccoon, just looking for more of them. But I'm not going to do that, because that would indicate that I had a problem. Well, in any event, you know, never before have I realized the truth of when Josh from EH Vending actually says, who's our target audience, Rick? It's your everyday worker, someone who likes to snack all day, like you, Rick. And then he put a little smiley face. He says, you've never been shy about how much you like to eat things. That really is true.
Yeah, that is true.
Contact EH Vending. They provide all styles of vending, from the traditional to the, you know, to snack, to soda, to office coffee supplies. They can customize to fit your needs, you know, it can actually be an enjoyable relationship. You're not going to, you know, it's not going to be with some business with some company never returns your calls. 360-816-1853 or ehvending.com.
Was it like that?
Oh, my God, that's exactly what it was. It was those right there.
Mrs. Freshley's...
What are they called?
This is a peanut butter buddy bar.
Yes, that's exactly what it was, Don.
Okay.
Oh, my God, you have no idea. They were so good. I wish you hadn't shown that to me. The thing is, I don't know where to buy them.
I have never seen the Mrs. Freshley's brand anywhere.
Me either. I wondered if it was like an East Coast thing, like Tasty Cakes.
Mm.
But yeah, they were in the box, and then they were in my stomach. And boy, by God, they were good. I can't even tell you. It was... I'm going to look at the box later. All right, we should do the top five.
Okay.
I'm so filled with shame. Here's your... I hate me. Here's your top five for Tuesday on the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
One, fire.
It's amazing I don't have an eating disorder of some kind.
It's amazing that you don't look like Harry Knowles.
It's so cruel. But I mean, if you're going to use an example, that's the guy. I mean, really. Thanks, Don.
Probably shouldn't make fun of him since he just had this like terrifying medical thing happen to
that's
him this week.
Hard to imagine.
No, he it really is kind of fascinating. He's had problems with like, his back and his legs for a long time.
No.
I know. Go figure.
Get out.
But he was with his wife like just this week doing something for her birthday, and he got out of the car and he said he felt just what felt like needles up and down his legs, and his back was just in horrible pain, but it was like he was being stabbed with needles in his legs. And they took him to the ER, and he had some kind of a rupture or a problem with one of his vertebrae that was so bad they said he was in danger of like snapping his spinal cord.
Really?
He had to go like immediately into surgery, and they said that it was like it was so wonked out that if he had like tripped and fallen down, it could have actually severed his spinal cord.
Jesus. Okay.
And then so at first they were talking about cracking open his chest and getting at his spine
right
through his chest, like moving his organs apart to get to it. And so he was like going, oh, that'll be awesome. But they brought in some amazing neurosurgeon who was able to actually do it with a minimally invasive, like, 5-inch suture in his back, his upper back.
That's
and
pretty
then fixed his spine. But he's going to be going through, like, physical therapy and stuff for, I guess, several months now.
Oh, see, now I feel bad for laughing. That's pretty amazing, like the thing with Patrick where they just put the little tiny holes in him and they were able to extract the gallbladder and then whatever. Didn't he start Ain't It Cool because he was stuck in bed?
Something like
for
that,
for, like, 6 months because, I don't know, he fell down some stairs or he did something. I mean, he's a man of larger
but
carriage.
Also, the thing is, though, that they, when he was in the ER and they did stuff, when he woke up after the surgery, because he, of course, has been blogging about all of this because he's a huge attention whore. But when he woke up after the surgery, he realized all of a sudden all of these parts of his body that either hurt or he had had no sensation in, suddenly he could feel again.
Weird.
That it's like I think it's like you get when you're chronically ill. He was so used to feeling miserable and terrible.
This is how I'm supposed to feel.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden realizing, oh my God, I can feel like my legs. I can feel the skin by my knees, and I had no sensation. Weird stuff like that. That he had literally had no idea how close to being like Christopher Reeve he was.
Wow, that's okay. Well, now I officially retract my guffaw from earlier because I guess I hadn't. Because that's.
I mean, we can still mock him for being a huge, horrible monster of a man, but he. But that doesn't
can
change
we?
The fact he did have like this terrible medical thing happen to him.
The thing about Ain't It Cool, and look, I hate to even say this because it's like I feel like I'm just a horrible person for knocking him at all because he really has been such an influential figure in so many ways. But it's like it's not even his side because I love that side and I go to Ain't It Cool every day. But I do have to say but of all of the people who regularly write or blog or post on that site. If there's ever a person whose posts I will probably skip, it's Harry's because every movie review, it's like is at the end of 9 pages of When I was four in 1977 and, you know, and Al Pacino was having dinner at our house, you know, in Dallas or whatever. And it's like it's just and it and also like at a certain point, you got to go like you got a spell check, man.
Yeah.
You got a spell check. Your computer has a grammar check. I know. I've seen it. I've used it myself. Just press the button that just says fix stuff automatically. It just hurts my eyes after a while. So
no, it is an ugly, ugly site, and it remains an ugly, ugly, wonky, difficult to – I mean, honestly, there's this point where you're just kind of going, man, you're a millionaire now,
yeah,
aren't you? Could you get somebody to make this easy to look at and navigate through? Because
well,
it's horrible.
And they revamped it a while back. I don't know if the last time you went there was, but it's like I really do love the Ain't It Cool message boards. And I don't say that about any site because message boards are usually just like the last – the bottom rung of creation. And so is Ain't It Cool, but in a sort of fantastic, glorious way. There's a sort of like horrible trolling and snarking that happens on Ain't It Cool specifically that is unlike any other site. Like at any other site, it's like it just becomes like a whole lot of like, you know, you're Hitler. Well, you're a libtard. You're a whatever. And it's like
so is your mom.
Yeah. And it's just and it just becomes ridiculous. There's something really great, though, about. There's something like simultaneously overeducated and yet puerile and juvenile about it's just like a it's like a bunch of like discarded Kevin Smith characters in a room, all of them drunk, kicking each other in the balls over and over again. And it's fantastic. But it's like they do this thing with the message board now where you have to click on every individual post to read
yeah.
it.
Oh, I know.
You can't just scroll through and read the freaking thing. You have to like actually click on every post, which I guess is maybe so you can ignore trolls or something you don't want to read. But it seems like you can. There's a better way to do that.
It also probably grossly amplifies the number of click-throughs on their site.
Which
affects advertising revenue.
It's a pain in the ass, though. I don't care for that at all. So that actually has diminished the amount of time that I will spend on that site. But, you know, what are you going to do? Also, they never publish any of my reviews, even the ones that I labor over for hours and hours and hours. Too busy publishing things, my fat boy. What?
You wrote a book.
Well, that's true. All right, here's your top five. I'm sorry, I already played the opening. Blah, 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 wonderful, blah, 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 wah, 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 wah.
So do you want to refresh them on what this is about?
Yeah, sorry. Yes, hello. Hi, it's the Rick Emerson Show. Your top five today. So this was prompted by Sweet Caroline by Neil Diamond. We played yesterday, and we were noting how everybody does the bum, 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 bum part. And so this is the top five songs containing a segment or portion or section or moment during which everyone in the room, whether they like or love the song or whether they know any of the other words, everybody must join in and sing along.
Right.
Top five songs containing a moment that everybody must sing along with.
Right.
All right.
Our honorable mention is You've Got to Hide Your Love Away, The Beatles.
Is it the Hey part?
It is the Hey.
What a great song.
So if you've ever been in a bar where somebody decides to sing this for karaoke or something, everyone will just sort of ignore the singer up to the point where you get the, and everyone in the bar will go, Hey! You know,
just the other thing that people will do, there's a Beatles song, it's Get Back, where it's like I'll be in a bar and suddenly everybody just goes like, Tucson, Arizona! And then that's it, and that's all they know. I do have to say there is one omission on this list that is so egregious. It's a good list.
Thank
but
you.
There's one that I, there's one here that I will point out afterward. But I
well,
never
there's one that I had considered putting on here that I ended up not.
I wonder if it's the same one.
I don't know.
Okay, well we'll compare notes afterward. This is great though, because this had never occurred to me, but it's totally true. How can I even try? You know what I'm a sucker for? I am a sucker for a lot of things in music. I am a sucker for pop bands singing a waltz. I don't know why. There's something hardwired into the human psyche about the waltz time. And it's a great song. How could she say to me, love will find a way. Gather round all you clowns. Let me hear you say. Got to hide your love away. Hey, you've got to hide. When I was living in Utah some years ago, when I was living in Utah in the mid-90s, I went to a handful of gay weddings, which in Utah is an even 10 years ago, it was a big deal for most places in the country for there to be any sort of a gay wedding. I mean, they weren't legally recognized, obviously. But in Utah, it's an exponentially bigger deal. And there's a lot more sort of stress and worry and, you know, whatever. And this song seemed to pop up with astonishing regularity as one of the songs that would be performed at the wedding.
I could see that.
Yeah.
Yes.
But that had never occurred to me, the whole thing about the hey part, that everybody in the bar probably does that.
Oh, yeah.
Well spotted, Don Taylor.
Thank you.
The top five songs featuring a section to which everybody must sing along.
Number five is What is Dead or Alive, Bon Jovi.
That's right. It's how this show rolls.
Yeah.
I'm glad you put this on the list. I was afraid that you would resist it.
No.
Just, you know, out of
No, I really don't like this song, but
this song?
But it fits the theme. You're absolutely right.
What kind of American are you?
I think it's that whole being a cowboy on a steel horse I ride thing, which I've always found painfully pretentious and irritating.
The fact that you would find Bon Jovi pretentious is sort of awesome and ridiculous and great. Well,
they always seem to me like they always struck me as being on the outside of heavy metal and not being someone who listened to metal at all.
Right.
They always seemed to me like a pop band who was posing as metal.
Well, I don't know that I would disagree with that. I mean, I don't even know that they were posing as metal. I think their record company decided that they were, you know. I think that was a sort of sheen that got put on them. But no, I can get with that.
And seeing pretty boy John Bon Jovi try to fashion himself as a biker just always seemed just patently ludicrous to me.
I will tell you that the thing that makes Bon Jovi great to me, somebody once said about U2 that if U2 wasn't so full of crap, they wouldn't be as great as they sometimes are. To me, that is like the great thing about John Bon Jovi, about the band, is that they're such a construct. They're sort of like Lady Gaga, actually, in that way. Ryan White had talked about how Lady Gaga was fascinating because there was nothing real about her. It was all a surface facade. Every little bit of it was constructed. Now, maybe she was the one who contrived it and constructed it, but it really wasn't her in any way. Built from on an assembly line.
Yeah, it's much the same way that Madonna was always really fascinating because she was almost more admirable as a businesswoman than she was as an artist.
And I think that's my thing about Bon Jovi is like he's just some schnook from New Jersey, you know? He's a guy with a decent voice who writes an okay song now and again and whatever. But it's like, you know, by the time he gets to you via MTV or or a record or whatever, he has become like an outlaw, a six shooter, wielding that guitar on his back and rocking a million faces and, you know, riding down an endless road of tears. Wait for it. Right there. you know, but just on, like on an endless trail of sadness and grit and dirt and a hard scrabble life, you know, like a cowboy singer, outlaw, biking, traveling rock guy, you know, and it's looking out like, you know, and like on the tour bus, like looking out the window really sadly and in grayscale photography, you know, being carried off stage by the roadie in slow motion because he's given his all to the people. I mean, and he really did that better than anyone in this era.
Also, he starred in one of the most hilariously awful vampire movies ever made. The sequel to John Carpenter's Vampires, it was called Vampires, Los Muertos. Straight to video.
That's unfortunate.
And oh my God, it is just mind-bendingly awful.
Wow. All right, so here's where every drunk in the bar screams. That, by the way, was the shout that convinced somebody to give Richie Sambora a solo deal. If you think Bon Jovi's embarrassing, you should listen to Richie Sambora's solo record, Stranger in Town, where at one point, I swear to Christ, I think he's performing with B.B. King, and he describes himself as like carrying a bucket full of blues, you know, and it's so bad. It's so astonishingly bad.
As someone with a bit of a fetish for guys with big noses, though, I will say Richie Sambora. Good-looking man.
Oh, yeah?
In that big-nosed David Duchovny kind of a way.
I got to tell you, I saw Bon Jovi at the Rose Garden a couple years ago. Hey, you know. Hold on a second. I'm going to do this while I'm thinking
about it.
Are
you going to pull your hair products out again?
Yes.
Are you not tousled enough?
I am. I'm going to hand this to you right now.
Okay.
That is a...
Awesome.
That's a DVD copy of A Bigger Than Jesus.
Oh, that photo is delightful.
That's a Polaroid. That's a scan of a Polaroid taken by my friend Ellen when I was 15.
Oh.
Going to school dressed as Paul Stanley for no reason. There is a whole section about Bon Jovi.
Okay.
But I got to tell you, I saw them at the Rose Garden, and it was because I'm an unashamed Bon Jovi fan at this point in my life, and to hear like however many people, 12,000 people or something, all doing the what thing is sort of it is sort of great. I mean, it is like you do realize how much. Whether you like the band or not, you realize that any band that can get that, how much it does foster a sense of community, and I know other people who are into other kinds of music, they have their own sort of equivalent to that. But I mean, we've all been at a show where like everybody in the crowd knew some line or some word, and you look around, you're like, this is pretty freaking amazing. Like, this is as dumb as this sounds. Where the first concert that Lara ever took me to see was the Indigo Girls, who I became a really, really big fan of. But you know, I think for obvious reasons, there's a sort of a sense of insularity sometimes if you go to a concert like the Indigo Girls, because there's a something of a shared experience, I think, among a lot of the people in that audience. But it's like
In other words, I went to go see the Indigo Girls with my best friend. And at one point, about halfway through the show, I just leaned over to her and I said, you realize everyone thinks we're dating.
Yeah, it was. I won't say I was the only man there, but I will say that I was one of a scant handful. But I really became a huge fan. But the first time I went to see them, I think I knew like Closer to Fine or whatever the radio hit was. And but it was like everybody knew every single word of every single song. And yet, even with everybody singing along to every song, it was weird because there were still moments where you could tell that they really like were like hella singing this one part, and it would be like some shout out or some point where the music stops and there's like a little a cappella bit for like 4 seconds and everybody in the crowd would shout it. And those are great moments, which is why I'm glad that you've put together such a great list here. So these are the top five songs containing moments, sections, or segments to which everybody must sing along.
Number four is Kiss, I Wanna Rock and Roll.
That's right. And the live version.
And this particular, listen to the opening.
Oh, hey.
I first noticed this phenomenon at a party I was at in my early 20s. This song came on the stereo, and every guy in the house just immediately piled into the living room while all the women, like, just kind of peered into the room from elsewhere going, what's the deal? And I've noticed that about this song. Most people, I think, don't actually know the words to this song.
No.
But when you get to the chorus, everybody sings.
It's like some sort of musical bat signal has gone up. Everybody to the living room. You know, away to the sofa where we sing along with Kiss. I love Paul Stanley. The thing about this song is that their manager, Bill O'Coin, told them this was on their third record. And they had sold no copies of their first record. No, they never would have made it today. They would have been dropped by the label after the first record. But their manager said, look, you got one more record before they're probably going to boot you off the label. He said, if you're really going to make a go of it, he's like, you've got to write an anthem. So you have to write something people can sing along with. And they were in Eugene, Oregon, after a show. They were in their hotel in Eugene. And presumably after betting dozens of groupies, they sat in Paul Stanley's hotel room in Eugene, Oregon, and the first thing they did was come up with the chorus, because they were like, we have to have something that people can chant along with, even if they are drunk, stoned, or stupid. Thus, voila.
Yep.
This is the version of Alive, which means that eventually you get that great moment where Paul Stanley... I don't know when guys in rock suddenly started just instructing the audience that it had to be louder, because I can't hear you. Yes, you can. You're right there. You're 3 feet away from the audience, and also there's 20,000 of them. That's just a lie. Can't hear them. That's just ridiculous. You, I imagine, have never seen Kiss live.
I haven't, sadly.
It really, even if you loathe Kiss, I always tell people this, and there are people who loathe Kiss.
And you know, I did it one time, but honestly, over the years, they really grew on me. I actually love Kiss. Now.
I think that it's, like, I think everybody has to see Kiss just because, again, leaving aside whether you like them or hate them, Peter Carlin hates Kiss. But I keep trying to get him to go see them because I'm like, You will never, for good or bad, you will never be at a concert experience like a Kiss show. unless you're seeing a band that has just ripped everything off from Kiss. I mean, in terms of the visual, and it's the overload and the immense pyro from the very first song and never stopping, to the billion pounds of confetti, you know, to Ace Frehley having a guitar that smokes and shoots rockets and levitates, to Paul Stanley on a Tarzan vine swinging above the crowd, a guy spitting blood and breathing fire before sprouting demon wings and flying over the audience's heads, and then 20,000 people all singing this at the same time. I mean, it really is quite unlike anything you will ever experience. You may not like it, but you will never experience anything quite like this. Awesome. These are the top five songs containing sections with which you must sing along. Don Taylor?
Number three is the Eagles, Take It to the Limit.
Wow, I'll take Whiplash Segway for 1,000. I love this song. I'm so glad you put this on the list.
Yeah. My problem when I was putting this together, it's really hard for me to not sing along with the Eagles. You know, and I was like going, God, we're going to be on the air and I can't like just sit there and sing. But anytime I'm in the car and I hear an Eagles song, I just can't not sing along with the Eagles.
They're perfectly crafted songs. And the great thing about the Eagles, too, is they have that really lush, that lush, really, really layered, perfected harmony. The great thing about that, though, is as opposed to just you and the lead singer, because everything has that really, that great sense of deep harmonic to it, no matter what your voice is or whether you can sing or not, you will always sound like you are fitting in perfectly between two of the singers in the band. Your voice will find its natural groove in this song. I will say this, because I know there are a lot of people who dislike the Eagles. It's sort of fashionable to mock the Eagles. You do that until you get dumped by a girl and it's 2 a.m. and you're drunk. And then this, even if not before that moment, it'll be the best thing you've ever heard. Right there. How can you, like, it causes me almost physical pain not to sing.
Was it the long run that Joe Walsh was with them, or?
He joined for Hotel California.
Okay. Because I remember reading an article in Rolling Stone about him going on tour with them and how much, like, Glenn Frey hated him. Mainly because he was just drunk all the time and he wouldn't show up for rehearsals. And they'd get on stage and he wouldn't even look at the set list. He'd just look over and see if the other guys were playing. And then play.
Yeah.
And still be brilliant.
It'd be fantastic. Yeah, it's funny. I don't know why. Maybe it's because we were talking about this song. We must have been talking about the Eagles at some point recently. Because I found myself one of those things where you find yourself at 3 a.m. reading a Wikipedia entry from top to bottom. And then all of the related Wikipedia entries. Like last weekend, literally, I sat at home and I read the Eagles. Oh, we're coming up on the thing here. I was early.
Please.
That's awesome. I read the Eagles Wikipedia entry top to bottom, and then Joe Walsh's, and it was just about how much they all just despised each other, and that they would actually exit the stage on different sides, enter the stage on different sides. There was apparently some notorious concert in L.A. where Don Felder and Glenn Frey, between every song, would go over and they would talk to each other for a second, and everybody, it looked like they were just sort of tuning their guitars, but it was a whole lot of like, I'm going to kick your ass later. I'm going to kick your ass later, fatso. You know, and it was just like a lot of like, and it was like all of this like horrible. And then Joe Walsh, they all just hated him because, he's basically a human Muppet. I mean, have you ever seen him interviewed? He just seems like he's such a goof. You know, he doesn't take anything seriously. He just seems like he's just perpetually high, and I don't even think he is anymore, but he just seems like a little Fraggle Rock creation. But then, yeah, you put give him a guitar, and he's just, you know, and he's just a Jedi. So, and then when they got back together for that Hell Freezes Over tour, that ended with them all suing each other again, which was awesome. God damn, what a great song. Yeah, excellent. Top five songs that contain moments with which you must sing along. Don Taylor.
Number two, David Bowie, Suffragette City.
Yeah.
And I think we all know what part I'm talking about.
This sounds like a weird comparison, but I was talking about Seth Aaron from Project Runway. And I mentioned to you during the break that I was sitting next to him and just, you know, sort of thinking like this is the most stylish guy that I've, you know, that I've ever seen in my life in you know, up close and in person. He had this, and you and I were talking about it, some people can try to learn, you can figure out how to be stylish, and some people just know it, it's effortless. Seth Aaron looks effortlessly stylish the way that David Bowie sounds and sings in an effortlessly stylish way. I mean, he also, you know, visually is, you know, knows what he's doing. But I mean, when you hear this song and you're just like, he just is this cool. I mean, David Bowie just is this effing awesome.
Well, I posted a video on Facebook a few weeks ago that I found, and it was from some British TV show, and it was Bowie from just a couple of years ago, maybe 5 years ago, doing Ziggy Stardust.
Right.
But just standing there, you know, now like 60-year-old David Bowie in a suit and his skinny tie and doing things. And singing Ziggy Stardust. And he was just the coolest guy on the planet.
Yep. And you can't teach somebody how to do that. People can hone a sort of, you know, if they have presence and charisma, they can, I don't know, if you get a little confidence to go with that. But that's a thing you either have or you don't. There's no teaching a guy to be that awesome.
But also there's no reason why a guy who's as old as your grandpa doing this song, you know, from
right.
1971 or whatever it is, when he was a spiky-haired bisexual androgyne.
It should be pathetic.
It should be pathetic, and it's not. It is so cool, and he still has such chops.
Yeah. Well, that's the same thing, I think, with Keith Richards, you know? Where Keith Richards, if you look at him on paper, he should look, again, like a pathetic, used-up husk of a wreck. You know, he's thatchy gray hair, and he's wrinkled, and he's wreathed in cigarette smoke, and he slurs, and he stumbles, and he's an unattractive man, and always was, and he's like 1,000 years old, and he should not work. And yet he comes into a room, you are like, you are so effortlessly, awesomely badass. And same thing with David Bowie. How great is that?
By the way, in my instructions for my memorial service after my death,
uh-huh.
I have instructed that at some point everyone has to stand in a circle and dance to this song.
That's genius. I don't even know what that means. I mean, I don't even know what the song is about. I don't know why he's singing that right there. He probably doesn't know what it means. Oh, man. I mean, it's so good. And again, he himself probably could not explain why that needed to be in the song or why it was important that line be included. But he just sort of, you know, he kind of just knew that it was important. It had to be there. Wow. That's great. That's wonderful.
That particular song right there, I think, just sums up why I have loved David Bowie since I was 12 years old. Just everything about that song.
It is just, it's great in every possible way. If you were to list all of the various means and methods by which a song could be great, that meets every criteria. I mean, it's well written, it's well performed, it's loud, but it has subtlety. You can sing along to it, but it's edgy and grimy, but it's not like sleazy sort of schlock rock.
But it also has that frenetic adrenaline drive that some rock has.
Vitality.
Where you, you feel it like in your solar plexus. You actually feel it making you jittery and jumpy and want to get on your feet.
Well, it gives you a rush. Yeah, I mean, it is a hyperkinetic and frenetic song. And yeah, you do. Ozzy Osbourne talked about hearing Little Richard and saying that it was like you heard it and it was like this sort of, you know, like you'd just been hit with adrenaline, you know, like somebody had just, which I think is why, I think that's why a lot of musicians end up doing like coke. In addition to A, it gives you the confidence to stand in front of 50,000 people and be like, I'm awesome. But also, and to stand in judgment, you know, by all of those people as you play a song. But also, I think because it's that rush, you know, it simulates the rush.
You undoubtedly get addicted to that adrenaline rush, that serotonin, you know, input that you get from playing music, from performing.
I have the weirdest top five, and then we'll do number one here. I have the, and then we'll end for the love of God. I have the I have the weirdest top five that I've been wanting to do for the longest time, and maybe this is the time I can do it because it seemed too weird to do, especially because I'm lame. I wanted to do, you have to follow me on this, I wanted to do the top five songs that sound like cocaine feels. Now, keep in mind, I really have no idea, I'm not the guy to ask, but it's just my sort of idea of, you know, like if one was just to like, you know, like lay out, like, you know, rack out just big lines of cocaine and go, well, this cocaine, there's all this cocaine here, I say we do it. It's the sort of, there are a handful of songs that I can think of that when I hear them, I think, I bet this is what it feels like to be on really good cocaine when I hear this song.
It's so interesting because in a completely different sense, I was thinking about a top five of just, and you've probably done this before, but I was thinking of a top five of cocaine songs this morning because, as I told you when you came in this morning, I was listening to Pandora. And for some reason, you know, when you do a social distortion station on Pandora, the second most common artist after social distortion on that stream is Johnny Cash.
Right.
And the first one that came up was Cocaine Blues,
right.
the live version from
Live at San Quentin.
Yeah. And I was enjoying the hell out of the song because it's just this horrible song about this horrible man who kills his wife.
And is on the run.
Yeah. And everyone, every time he talks about like shooting somebody or doing something, or everyone in the crowd is like, hey! You know, but then he ends it with the message. It's like, cut back on the whiskey and stay away from the cocaine,
right.
Which is the end of the song. But that's not really the message. The message is being an outlaw and shooting people is awesome.
Yeah, you don't really take away the what I learned today part of that. Yeah,
no.
it's like the Folsom Prison Blues, you know, where everybody just loves the whole like shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. That's awesome. I want to do that. You know, and you sort of overlook the fact that like he's in prison singing the song, you know, the narrator has been incarcerated. But you don't really think about that. You just think about, like, what a badass he is. Well, I might do that at some point. Because we've done top five songs about cocaine. You and I should both do the list, though, of the top five songs that sound like a good cocaine rush. I would be curious to know, because you've made no secret of your substance use in the past. I won't say abuse necessarily, but your use of substances. I would be curious to know how similar – we're probably not going to overlap in terms of the actual songs. I'd be curious to know how similar our lists sound, though, the kind of song that we pick.
Okay.
So I'll see if I can put mine together for tomorrow.
Yeah.
The Rick Emerson Show about to conclude here. We are doing the top five songs that require audience sing-along or participation at least one moment. They contain a segment that everybody must sing along with. Don Taylor?
Number one is Phil Collins' In the Air Tonight.
You know what's funny is we had just talked about doing this list, and I think I sent you some of my suggestions. And then last night while I was at home, I was doing laundry or something. I was folding laundry, and I was watching The Hangover. And have you seen The Hangover?
Yeah.
Which is a great film anyway, and it's a movie that I quite love. But then there's that whole sequence with Mike Tyson where he's doing the whole, like, you know, the drumming thing. And Collins himself has talked about this, about how weird it is that he will be in the audience and he looks out and it's like, you know, 50,000 hands at once all doing the drumming thing. Here's a fun fact. You Rush fans in the house will already know this. So Rush put out a live album some years back called A Show of Hands. And that is a reference to the fact that during many of their songs, because they've got this amazing drummer, that they would look out and they would just see nothing but hands in the air replicating like every drum hit perfectly, like air drumming along with them.
Wow.
So that is something very like primal and tribal, I think, in the human mind.
The audience participation thing can get out of hand, though, because I know that Bare Naked Ladies stopped performing If I Had a Million Dollars in concert because they got tired of people throwing boxes of Kraft macaroni and cheese at them.
Yeah. Well, it's one thing if you're Paul and Storm and you're getting underwear thrown at you. If you're getting a pointy cardboard thing hurled at your head, which I have seen, and I've seen those guys do that song, and it's like, and that was one of those things where I didn't really know them all that well. I kind of knew that song, and Lara told me, she's like, any minute now, she's like, watch the macaroni. And I think it was before they had sort of issued a moratorium on that, and they actually like took cover. You know, they're like, you know, blah blah blah, Kraft macaroni, and they then immediately like lifted up their guitars, and this just like this fusillade of just, I mean, it was like they were being mortared by Kraft macaroni and cheese, and that's when you realize you got to be careful what you instruct lunatics to do because they will do it.
Oh yes.
See, this song, the existence of this song and one or two others, make it impossible for me to totally hate Phil Collins. Because you hate him, and then you hear this, and you go, well, this song is still pretty fantastic. Even, here's the great thing about the song is, even the dated aspects of it sort of still work, you know?
Yeah, he had this great, like, early, or you know, late 80s, like, Miami Vice period, where he actually did some really awesome music.
Well, and he had that... the song that I Don't Care song, I think, or the one that he did after his divorce. He had a whole series of divorce songs. And like, what is that song? The Take a Look at Me Now song or whatever. Yeah, you know, he had some stuff that came out of that, but this is really the high watermark. The fact that this is so, that like that drum machine, and that they're not even pretending it's real drumming, it very, you know, which is ironic because he is a drummer, that it's just this electronic drum loop. And this weird, harsh phasing on his voice. Even the fact that sounds so dated works in the sense that it makes the song sound removed and clinical and a little creepy. It makes it sound otherworldly.
And I'm not sure why, but I love the song Land of Confusion. And I feel like every time I hear it, I feel a little bit, like, guilty. Like, maybe I shouldn't like it because it's so corny.
That's okay. What are you going to do?
But...
you know.
But again, though, that driving, you know, bass and drum underbeat to that song just gets me every single time.
Wait for it. Yeah. I mean, you can't. I was at my father's place a few years ago, and this came on, and it was like, I was having a conversation with somebody, and as the song kept going, I was like, my eyes were darting around, and finally I just said, shh, you just have to quit talking for like 60 seconds. Hold on. I have to do something. And I just was looking at the bar, and it was like this moment of like, the anticipation was almost, it was like, it was just killing me. It was like, I was just sort of tensing up, and like, you know, just waiting for that moment, and then everybody in the bar does it, and then two guys like literally at the bar like high five and then go back to drinking. And I was like, okay, I can concentrate now. I can go back to the conversation.
Well, they have this recurring sketch on Saturday Night Live that is brilliant with Bill Hader and a couple of guys, and where them talking in between the chorus of this one particular song, and so they end up, and it's really beautifully timed. They have to get like the jokes and the conversation in between, because
right.
The joke being that they just stop what they're talking about to sing the chorus of the song every time it comes up, sitting in the bar. And in a completely dorky sort of similar way, I was having coffee once several years ago with Mike Russell and this coworker of ours. And just sort of in the background while we were talking, I think all three of us became aware that the theme from The Greatest American Hero started playing. And we just kept talking, and we're surrounded by people in this coffee shop, and we just keep talking. And at the same time, when the chorus comes up, we all just start going, believe it or not, I'm walking. And everyone turns and looks at us, and we realize, God, we are such dorks.
Such retards. Okay, what song did you almost put on the list? Because I have, there's one to me, and I don't know what you would take off the list, but to me there's one that I don't know how you don't put it on,
well,
and
mine,
I've got it queued up.
Mine is probably not the same one that you would pick. Mine would have been YMCA by the Village People.
Oh, no, good one. No, I could see that.
Because not only does everyone always sing along with that, they also do the arm gestures.
Okay, no, that's valid. I could see that. I could see that. To me, there's one that jumped out to me, and it is one where it only is one specific moment. And again, it's like the thing of Suffragette City, where as soon as I start this, and I'm going to make you wait until we're done with the credits of the show. As soon as I start it, you will know exactly what moment in the song I am talking about. I will say that you want to join us tomorrow, when our guests will include Kelly Clark from Willamette Week. Thursday, we'll talk to Anna Griffin from The Oregonian. Friday, Mr. Big Jim Willig will be here with another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101. We want to thank our guests, including us today, and so forth. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the Milkpacking District in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, Don Taylor, advanced technology and magic provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Agler, chief of staff, and obtainer of Seth Aaron, Cheryl Kanakoa. So the Rick Emerson Show made possible by a generous grant from y'all. It is Tuesday, January 18th, 2011, and that is the frequency. Kenneth, speaking of that is the frequency, Kenneth. Here's your show ending song. It's the Rick Emerson radio program. We'll see you tomorrow at noon for Legion of News. Thank you all for listening.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Turn world, serve its own needs. Dummy, serve your own needs. Feed it up a knock, speak grunt, no strength. The ladder starts to clatter with. The fury's breathing down your neck. Team by team reporters babble Trump, tethered crop. Look at that, no plane, fine, then. Uh-oh, overflow, population common food, but it'll do. Save yourself, serve yourself. World serves its own needs, listen to your heartbeat. Dummy with the rapture and the reverend and the right. Right, you patriotic, patriotic, slam, fight, bright, light, feeling, pretty sight.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world.
Don't get caught in foreign tower, slice and burn, return. Listen to yourself, churn. Locking in, uniform and book, burning blood, letting every motive escalate. Automotive, incinerate. Light a candle, light a motor, step down, step down. Watch your heel crush, crush, uh-oh. This means no fear, cavalier, renegade, steer clear. Tournament, a tournament, a tournament of lies. Offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world.
Lester Banks, birthday party, cheesecake, jelly bean, boom, you symbiotic, patriotic, slam, button, nap, right?
Right. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel it's the end of the world as we know it.